curious. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Interim Committee on Healthcare. It's Monday, September 18th, and we have new staff. We have Cassandra Susi, we call her Cassie, who is going to be our administrator, and Ashley Clark is our
committee assistant.
And I would like to, Elizabeth's going to be here. They scheduled full ways and means at the same time, but she should be here shortly. With that, we have a full agenda and a timeline, so I'd like to start the informational hearing. Oh, first we have to adopt committee rules. I will open the organizational meeting for the adoption of committee rules.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 18, 2017.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 18, 2017. Is there any discussion? And Cassie, you said there was not much change, if any. That's right. Okay.
And Madam Chair, we ignore the rules when it's in our best interest anyway.
Okay. Is there any opposition?
Put that on record.
They are adopted. Okay, we will now, I think everyone knows, just introduce yourselves for maybe some new people out there, starting with Lee.
I'm Lee Byer, State Senator from District 6, which is Central Lane and Linn Counties.
Jeff Cruz, I'm Senate District 1, Southwestern Oregon.
Tim Canope, Central Oregon.
And Lori Monis Anderson, I represent East Multnomah County, Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview. With that, let's open a informational meeting on the Oregon Health Authority update. Patrick Allen, John Collins, and Wayne Haddad. And would you prefer questions interspersed, or would you like questions at the end?
Yeah, whatever you'd prefer.
We'll see what the committee. If Elizabeth was here, we'd wait till the end. But I think that we will intersperse if we need to.
Madam Chair, before they start, there have been many discussions going on relative to this. Conference calls, the governor convened with a lot of us who were part of that conference call. I just want to stay for the record on the front end. We made it relatively clear to the governor that we would prefer that Mr. Allen be made permanent. Not that we have anything against you, Pat, but so we're truly in flux and transition at this point in time. But I do think that the governor did the right thing by at least making you temporary at this point.
Well, thanks. With that as introduction, I guess. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the interim director of the Oregon Health Authority. We're here today in this portion of the update to get you up to speed with really the conclusion of the eligibility determination issue. And my role before I turn it over to others vastly more knowledgeable than me is to kind of give you a little bit of a history of how we got here. This is, we certainly believe, maybe one of the last echoes of the Cover Oregon situation from 2013-14. In 2014, as is well known, Cover Oregon failed in terms of the launch of its customer-facing platform. Our contractor delivered a back office product that worked sort of, and did not deliver a platform that our users were able to enroll on. In 2015, there was an assessment done to figure out, could we move forward with any of that platform, or did we need to make a change and move to a different platform? And the decision was made to take the Kentucky system, which was developed by Deloitte, port it over to Oregon, and bring it up as our platform, and it became known as the One System, the Oregon Eligibility System. A couple of decisions were made in that process that are important to know now. At the bottom of the One System column there in 2015, you see that CMS approved our plan to clean up Oregon Health Plan data. This is an artifact of the fact that we needed to use a manual process during this period of time when the Cover Oregon platform was not working before we were able to stand up the One platform. The other decision that was made was not to do a data conversion project, but to manually enter data into the One system. That was obviously labor-intensive, but the determination was made that that was a more time- and cost-effective approach to getting customer data into the system than actually doing a data conversion project. If you've ever been around big IT projects, data conversion ends up being one of the very most complicated pieces of that sort of a project. It had, however, the net effect of, again, delaying some cohort of individuals from being redetermined into the system. What was left were these 115,000 individuals that we've talked a lot about over the last several months that tended to be more complex cases that had been kind of kicked to the end of the pile while we worked through the large number of simpler, more straightforward redeterminations. And that's the work that we're here to update you on today. In May, the governor directed that the agency get that work done by August 31st, which we substantially did, short, I think, 30 or so individuals at that point. We're here to talk about, and now all individuals on Medicaid are on a regular renewal schedule, and so we don't anticipate this being any kind of a recurring problem, given that we're back on a normal schedule. With that, I'll turn it over to John.
Thank you, and Chair Montesanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, for the record. My name is John Collins. I'm the Director of the Office of Health Analytics within the Health Policy and Analytics Division of OHA. So first thing that we're presenting here is just some regular key facts, and I think we've actually presented this same slide to y'all in the past. Is just to give you an overview of how many people, what the percentage within each county is OHP. It's roughly 1/4 of the state. We've got roughly 85% of the OHP members enrolled in a CCO, and the Medicaid reforms that we've been working under, the last waiver has saved the state and federal taxpayers close to $1.3 billion since 2013. A substantial portion of these individuals are actually employed, and the economic impact of Medicaid is quite substantial as well. So who are the cleanup cases? Just in summary, as Pat mentioned, these tended to be some of the more complex cases we had in the Oregon Health Plan membership. They tended to be related to members who were pregnant, children under the age of one, some of the programs that aren't in the One system currently, such as the Breast and Cervical Cancer Program and Extended Medical. Some of the causes were related to discrepancies between the various legacy systems that we are working with towards the movement to the One system and eventually the IEME system. And in some cases, applications were started in One and not finished for various reasons, such as the need for additional information and such.
And that's about how many?
I don't have that number on me. We can go back and get that, though. The next slide just gives you a general overview of this set of 115,000 people in terms of what they were made up of for demographics. The main thing I'll point out here, and it's not necessarily illustrated, is a lot of the from a demographic point of view in terms of adults, children, male, female, non-ACA, ACA, this group of individuals did resemble the larger population to a great degree. The next slide was meant to illustrate basically a comparison between the expenditures on these general groups within the OHP population and the actual count. And what you really see here is that in some cases, there are certain numbers that are on the left in the people column, or bar, I should say, where the percentage is relatively small of the OHP population, such as people with disabilities, but their makeup in terms of spending is quite a bit larger than the proportion of the population. The other place where you see this is children. There are a lot of children on the OHP population, but the spending is relatively small compared to its size.
So you're basically saying that most of the expenditure is in with the
adults.
Adults.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
Gotcha. The next slide. So this is getting back to the 115,000 or so folks that we were talking about here that were in the action plan. At the end of August, at that point, we saw that roughly 60,000 of those individuals remained open, where the remainder ended up closing. And of those who closed, there was a certain percentage of them, about 58% of them, that closed due to non-response to the request for information that was sent out to them. And then 42% of them were closed as a result of administrative review. And I will say that of those that went through the administrative review with the information that was available about those individuals, a lot of them were referred over to the federal marketplace for further review. And the thing that I want to call out here, too, and the reason why we are calling this a preliminary report on the action plan is the set of bars down below is a look at the difference between initial numbers of individuals who close versus a 90-day period that allowed for a look back of retroactive actions on individuals, and what you'll see is that there's a pretty big change in terms of the initial results versus the final results. All that is to say that we expect after roughly 90 days the percentage of individuals who remained open from this 115,000 folks to be larger than the current 52%, whereas obviously the closed would be smaller than the current 48%. This is just a common kind of process in the Medicaid world, and we have to make sure we allow for some time to look back on this population.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Collins, one of the challenges we face, and I think about this with my Ways and Means hat on as much as anything, is that people who are retroactively determined to be eligible all end up on open card, right, instead of in the CCOs for that period of retroactivity. And that's much more expensive, generally speaking, than having them on the CCOs where we can manage their care. How do these numbers about closure and then redetermination compare to other states who did expansion as well? I mean, how are we doing at finding the people who need to be contacted and making sure that we don't end up with a significant population that is being redetermined?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward. I don't have a comparison with other states, but what I will say, and we have some other information that I could bring in to discuss with the committee or through separate meetings if you want, that the number of people, we've talked about this quite a bit in terms of retroactivity, and there was a large amount of retroactivity occurring for a significant portion of the population as we were doing the cleanup process. At this point, and that was partially because we had a backlog. We got behind with a number of folks. That backlog has gone, and there's much fewer people who are having to experience retroactivity for those particular reasons. So I do know that the population's decreased, which has decreased the percentage of individuals who are having to spend time in the open card population, but I don't have a comparison to other states.
Quick follow-up, if I may, Madam Chair. Thank you. Mr. Collins, the numbers, the most recent numbers you have on here are from March. Obviously, and that's the people who would have gone through determination in December, essentially, and completed their 90 days in March, right? So presumably, we should have more recent data. Are you able to give this committee data for, March was 6 months ago?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward. Actually, this was as of the end of March, so it gave us a 90-day look back to that. So it's, you know, you got April, May, June. So, yeah, we can go up a little bit further.
So these are people who went through determination in March and have completed their 90 days?
Right, and they're all going through the one system. And what you're noting here is actually a great deal of improvement in the numbers because the system itself is able to account for things better than we were under the manual processing that we were doing mainly back in 2016.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Senator Knopf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see the, you know, kind of the people impact, but what I don't see in your presentation is any financial impact to the system for the redeterminations. Could you discuss that a bit, please?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Knopf,
why don't you go to the next slide, which really gets at impact on the forecast, which I think.
Yeah, that would probably help. If I can go through this slide and then address your question. So at this point, in terms of addressing the forecast, we just recently came out with a variance report on the forecast, and the forecasters within OHA and DHS are beginning to prepare on the fall forecast. What you see in this particular line chart is a difference between the spring forecast and what the actuals were. And I'll point out that the actuals are in dark blue, and then the kind of orangey reddish color, I guess, are preliminaries of the actuals. And we were seeing a slight rise above the forecast, the spring forecast, in the early part of the year, but it has since come down and is starting to line up much more closely with the spring forecast. And at this point, our forecasters, we talk about this stuff every month when the variance reports come out and are published out on the web. We were able to have some explanation as to why initially there was a bit of a bump in terms of the actuals compared to the forecast, and we expected it to come down to line up with the forecast, and it since has. So at this point, we're not seeing any financial, or we're not anticipating any financial impact of these 115,000 people that we had to go through and pick up in a short amount of time through the action plan.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
So am I to take that because of the redeterminations and the lowering of the forecast and of the actuals that there are no savings attached to that?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Knopf, there aren't any savings anticipated, no.
If I could add to that, I think what you're seeing is that the 20,000 that have been administratively closed, and then the percentage of the 30,000 who we expect ultimately will remain closed after the retroactivity period, ultimately is a fairly small percentage of the 990,000 Oregonians who are on the system. And so when you look at the impact of those redeterminations, while there may be savings associated with that, it doesn't make a significant impact on the overall forecast for the system.
Can I follow up, though?
Yes.
So, Pat, though, from the peak, we're at about 1.2 million enrollees, and it looks like, I think you said, probably the Valley number, which is just under a million. Wouldn't there be substantial savings with 20-plus percent decrease in enrollees?
I think it's a 2% decrease in enrollees, not...
Well, if you go from 1.2 million to a million, to me that's 20%.
Oh, got it. I thought you were talking about the amount that were redetermined.
Yes.
Well, go ahead.
So you have to remember that when we do our budget for OHA, we're looking at an average across these months. So when we asked for our budget based off of this forecast, it was based on the average number of individuals that were forecasted per month to be on our caseload. And then we're looking at the actuals on a month-by-month basis. So what we're anticipating here is that the average for our actuals will end up lining up pretty closely with the average that we have for the forecast. So there's no savings or overage anticipated at this point.
If I may, Madam Chair, this is something that was addressed during the budget-setting process, Senator, and the forecast that you see here was the one that we were working off of when we adopted the legislatively approved budget at the end of the 2017 session. So this is about where we expected it to be from a fiscal perspective, and the 17-19 biennial budget for OHA reflects the decrease in enrollment that you see and that you've alluded to in this, but there isn't a significant change from what we anticipated as we were preparing this biennial budget compared to the numbers that Mr. Collins is reporting on now.
Yeah, I just have a comment to this, though. I like the trend line, you know, looks good on the forecasts, and it'll be interesting to see if during the January 19 session, if there's any increase at all, because in the January 15 and then in the January 17, it looks like it blipped up a little bit. I don't know if that was because of budget discussions or just actuals, but it'll be interesting to see if that green line kind of stays on that trend. So we'll have to be watching that.
Oh, yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's your assumptions about the major determinant in terms of enrollment and all that? Is it how does it relate to the obviously we have an improved economy, income levels, people are not moving off. What I assume more people are going to work, but so we're dealing with working poor.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Byers, there are a lot of factors that go into the different parts of the OHP caseload. I can't remember off the top of my head, but there's roughly 12 or so different buckets that are actually forecasted and then combined into the caseload. Some of them are more impacted by the economy than others. I would really prefer to push that question off to our forecaster, and maybe we can get a general response for you back from him in terms of some of the major inputs that he thinks are having an impact on the forecast. I will say that usually one of the largest things that has any impact on our forecast has to do with any kind of policy changes or changes that we're having to make with our information systems, as you've seen here in the past. But we can have that discussion with him, and I can bring back information.
To the extent it helps, I did move us back to the slide that talks about where the spending is, and you can see that there are significant categories of spending there that really don't relate very directly to the economy, people with disabilities, elderly, those kinds of things. And so while there's certainly an impact of an improving economy, it's not a one-for-one kind of an impact at all based on those categorizations.
If it's possible, I'd appreciate it just receiving some point what your assumptions are in building that.
Sure.
And send that to Cassandra and Cassie.
Yeah. Will do.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Chairman Montes Anderson and Vice Chair Cruz. I'm Wayne Haddad, and for the record, I'm Wayne Haddad, Vice Director of Business Information Systems for OHA. And I've got just two slides to talk about. The first one here is a bit of an eye chart, so I won't take you through all the detail, but the slides on the left, or the boxes on the left, represent the five systems that were in place for eligibility determination in the past and through the cleanup that we've been talking about. The two that are grayed out, the top one and the bottom one, are now being phased out. We've got a due process that's running for a couple hundred members. Once that's complete, those systems will be eliminated from the Medicaid eligibility population. We will not use them, in other words, for Medicaid eligibility going forward. Through the process, we've been able to enjoy some benefits. We've reduced the complexity of our systems. We've been able to, of course, eliminate the two of our systems, which helps with complexity. We've eliminated the Cover Oregon and Fast Track systems. The majority of the population is now in the one system with automated processing, so we have less manual work and more automated work in the newer technology one system. And that eliminated a lot of data entry and manual input in the prior systems or the old systems. It also improved our data quality. We're now able to verify, for example, Social Security numbers with the Social Security Administration. We can verify income with state and federal databases or sources. So that's helped. And then we've implemented some new controls to again, ensure this problem does not reoccur. Such as we're modifying our procedures for monitoring, we're developing new reports, and that kind of thing to ensure that this does not occur again in the future. The next slide just kind of summarizes some of the processes that we went through. our member services staff were used to work these cases along with some contractors. We had help from Shavs, Galt, PH Tech, and KPMG to complete the action plan in the time frame directed by the governor. We monitored, large group effort, but we worked on this heavily through the months of May through August, and we provided weekly reports to the governor on our progress. We also had assistance from our CCOs and our community partners. They helped us contact members, and through that reach out, it helped us, again, determine the appropriate course of action for each case. And it was also an opportunity for OHA and DHS to coordinate closely, particularly in the area of the processed aged and the APD membership, so the disabled and aged members, to make sure we handled those cases as efficiently as we could. That brings...
With that, we'd be happy to answer any other questions that you have.
I noticed on your last slide that you had CCOs and community partners helping with the eligibility. In your plan, do you see some process changes in working with the CCOs so that it may be easier for people to re-enroll through their own CCO, or are we still taking the stance that OHA is the one who has to determine?
Well, of course, that work now has moved over to DHS for initial sign-up, and then all the eligibility work is done there.
Right. And so we would need to talk to DHS to see if there is working with CCOs in them helping with the eligibility process.
Chairperson Monis Anderson and committee, DHS, I will be participating with DHS in a presentation to you this morning. We'll probably be able to provide more updates there. And
okay.
I believe, the CCOs and the community partners play a role in helping make sure the members get signed up properly and are put in the right coordinated care organization and that kind of thing. So I think some of that activity will continue. We can discuss it further if it's all right at that point.
That's great. Any other questions? Well, while I have you here, Pat, because I don't think you're...
I hope not.
Yeah. this isn't on the agenda, but I want to make a statement that I really hope that you and Family Care can maybe sort of get rid of this lawsuit by working together at the table together to see if maybe that lawsuit... instead of paying tens upon thousands of dollars for that lawsuit, if there's any chance that you could meet one and, together to work out some differences.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I can't obviously comment on the suit, but I did have a good meeting with leadership at Family Care last week, and we're working actively to reset the relationship.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. And... Kim Friedland,
and then
on the eligibility update, as you have already heard me talk about.
I will move right back into it.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Reginald Richardson. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Human Services. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, we're very happy to be here today. Wanted to just briefly describe some changes that have occurred at the Department of Human Services. This is the first time that DHS has presented to the committee for several years. Like OHA, we've had leadership change at our agency as well. For the day, the change to make sure the committee is aware of is that we have a new acting director, Fairboris Paxores, who started September 1st and will be going through confirmation later this afternoon. Even though there are many changes going on at DHS at this time, Fairboris and I believe the transition of medical eligibility work to DHS is a high priority within our department. I'd like to just say a few words about Kim Fredlin, our director of our self-sufficiency programs, who will be taking the lead in the presentation. What we're here to talk about today is the transition of medical eligibility work from OHA to DHS. As I just mentioned, Program Director Fredlin has been instrumental and a significant leader in this transition process. DHS, and in particular our self-sufficiency programs, has extensive experience with eligibility work. We believe Kim and her team are more than able to make this a smooth transition and continue partnering with OHA to make additional improvement in the process. At this point, what I'd like to do is to turn over the presentation to Kim and Wayne to describe what responsibilities are staying with OHA and what responsibilities transition to DHS and how we're working together to serve Oregonians. If it pleases the chair, I'd like to turn it over, and then I'm going to take my leave.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Kim Fredlund, and I'm the director of the self-sufficiency programs with DHS. And if I can get the mouse close enough. So we first wanted to talk a little bit about what exactly is transitioning and what is staying in the Oregon Health Authority. And the Oregon Health Authority will continue to be the single state Medicaid agency. They are accountable to the federal agency, CMS. They're responsible for the Medicaid policy interpretation, the implementation of any medical policy changes, and the quality and oversight. What DHS will be responsible for really is that actual eligibility center, the management of that eligibility center, and ensuring that Oregonians get that service that they need. I guess I'm out of practice driving and talking at the same time. So we started a two-phased approach to transitioning. The first phase of the transition is really that DHS assumed the management responsibilities on September 1st of the Eligibility and Enrollment Center. We have been working on, since earlier this year, operating agreements between the two agencies about how that work, who will be responsible for what, and how those agreements will come into place. And then we're also now in the middle of planning for the February session where we hope to get approval to move this through the legislative process, because there are budget and staffing and all of those things that still need to be worked out. So during this two-phased transition process, we actually, DHS, had a team of, they're in our department called Lean Leaders, so they're basically process improvement team, and I had them out at the Enrollment Center about 90 days before the transition began to really look at all of the processes that the staff were using, and we have mapped all of those processes so that we could really start on day one of understanding if there were any process improvements that we could take in order to get to a more efficient operating practice. So with self-sufficiency, we administer the SNAP program for the federal government, which many of you know as food stamps. We also administer the TANF program and the employment-related daycare program. So these are all eligibility programs that we have been operating for many years, and we used to also administer the eligibility for Medicaid before ACA and that transition. And with the SNAP program, which has got a large crossover with this Medicaid group of individuals, Oregonians, we have probably about a 65% crossover. And for the past 8 to 9 years, we did some process improvement during the recession to really streamline our processes around SNAP. And we administer the SNAP program where Oregonians get their benefits from the day that they apply, either the same day or next day, between 40 and 50% of the time. consistently, and we've been doing that now for years. We're one of the national leaders in actually administering that eligibility process, and so we want to bring that same standard to the Oregon Health Plan customers and make sure that we're able to really improve those processes to get to that point. We anticipate, based on the mapping or the review of the eligibility processes, that we anticipate that'll probably take us between 12 to 18 months to get to that point. And I'm going to turn it over to Wayne.
Hello again, Chairman Munoz-Anderson and Vice Chair Cruz. For the record, I'm Wayne Haddad, Director of Business Information Systems for OHA. And I wanted to, again, a couple of slides just to talk about what's happening in the world of technology related to these eligibility determination processes. So currently, there will be, or immediately, there will be no changes to our technology systems. We're going to make the upgrade to the one environment over the next several years, and that will allow us to then integrate the eligibility for Medicaid, both MAGI, non-MAGI, for SNAP, TANF, and ERDC into a single system. And then lastly, just a couple of comments on our communication with CCOs. As the single state Medicaid agency, OHA will continue to be the primary communication, have primary responsibility for communication with our CCOs. We'll manage meetings, policies, explanation of changes, those kinds of things. And DHS will work with CCOs. They'll attend these meetings. They'll also communicate on behalf of the Oregonians who have questions of the nature that affect their enrollment dates and other individual issues or concerns. So it's going to be collaborative between both agencies, but that's the process that will be in play.
So, Senator Munoz-Anderson, the question that you asked earlier about the CCO involvement in the eligibility process. So, currently, my understanding is that CCOs do a lot to help members be reminded that their renewal is needed, and they help with that connection and I believe, gathering of information and sending it on. DHS will still need to be the entity that is actually making an eligibility determination, but we do that in connection with a lot of partners, the regional outreach coordinators and all of the application assisters, CCOs, and as well as we'll be increasing the DHS field office support of making sure that we get all the information to process that eligibility as quickly as possible. But ultimately, it is and will be DHS's responsibility to make that final determination.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, I feel that communication with our CCOs and their contracting, there really needs to be as much transparency as possible, and I'm hoping that eligibility process is one thing, and then I'm jumping to the other contract issues, that it is a collaborative environment, and I think that those changes are, I see heads nodding, are going to be taking place. Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to follow up on that. I think it's understand that the final decision has to be made by DHS. That's real clear. Mm-hmm. But as much of that work as you can push out to the CCOs, which have the best contact with the people in the system, I would encourage you to do that. I think it makes a lot of sense to do as much of that in the field as you can, recognizing that, again, the customers need to know that they can make a change if they want.
Chair Munoz-Anderson, Senator Beyer, absolutely. I think we have a proven track record of working with various partners that come in contact with Oregonians to make sure that we, you know, get that process done as quickly as possible. We've done a lot in the SNAP program over the years to reduce, it's a word I hate, the churn, the people that are leaving and having to come back on, because we want to be proactive and keep that as seamless for families as possible. And we want to do that same for the Medicaid population. So anyone coming in contact with them, we would want to work closely with them to make sure that those benefits stay the same. It helps families. These are all families in poverty. And so it helps them to have a stable base if they're not having changes to their medical coverage or other benefit package. So, yes.
Thank you. And I just may add, if I might, Madam Chair, and Ms. Fredlin, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the interesting challenges that we face, and one of the reasons that I'm glad that this is living in DHS now, is that the eligibility requirements for these various programs vary a lot, mm-hmm. much more than one would think. There are people who are eligible for OHP who are not eligible for SNAP, or people who are eligible for ERDC who aren't eligible for OHP. It's really confusing, but having the information centralized in one database means that people who, as Ms. Fredlin mentioned, are really struggling to make ends meet are not being required to submit the same information time and time and time again. And it does streamline the eligibility determination, and it allows the system to identify what programs people might be eligible for. I'm not trying to take over your thunder, Ms. Fredlin, but having talked with you a lot about this during session, mm-hmm. because we were dealing with this on the Ways and Means side, I think it's important for this committee to have some understanding, you know, awareness of that as well.
So you are saying that it is, the information can be shared between SNAP and, that's what's great.
Chair Mona Sanderson and Senator Steiner-Hubert, thank you. Yes, absolutely. Every one of the programs have varying levels of eligibility requirements within them. It's not even as simple as, you know, each has only one set. There's multiple. So I think the challenge that we have is that there's some information that can be shared between the eligibility systems, and that's something that we'll now be able to strengthen with that work residing in the self-sufficiency programs. And then there's also, you saw on the previous slide that OHA was presenting, a large crossover with the senior and disabled population. So we work closely with the APD group in DHS to make sure that we're able to streamline as much of that information as possible and not ask the Oregonian to submit multiple documents. I will say that, again, I think we have some work to do to really get to that optimum place, because we have been separate now for 4 years, and so it's going to take just a bit of time, which, again, I anticipate will probably be about 12 to 18 months for us to really get to that place we need to get to.
So will that mean that contracts with CCOs, this is a Pat Allen question, may need to be extended?
It's a different issue.
I know it's a different issue, but I just remembered that question that I wanted to ask when he was up here.
Didn't leave quick enough.
Get out of the room. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Patrick Allen, Interim Director of the Oregon Health Authority. We are looking right now actively at the issue of either moving forward to a request for applications or considering whether to defer that for a period of time for a number of reasons. That would be one of them. There are others that relate to what do we want to get out of what we're colloquially calling CCO 2.0 and whether we're really ready to proceed on all of that. That's a decision that we'll be making shortly.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much, panel. And with that, we'll jump to Department of Consumer and Business Services update. Gene Strait, is it Cheeky Flowers and Rick Blackwell?
Hi. For the record, I'm Jean Strait, and I'm the Acting Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services. And we've been asked here today to give a little bit of an update on our leadership changes and update on our 1332 waiver application, 2018 rate review, and COFA oral health care program. So I have Rick Blackwell, our policy manager for our Division of Financial Regulations, and Chicky Flowers, our new administrator for the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace, and they're going to help me out with your more technical questions that you might have. So to start out with a few of our leadership changes, Chickie is part of those leadership changes. Barry Leslie went over to the governor's office, and Chickie stepped in as our interim administrator during session, and she was gracious enough to accept the permanent job and started on September 1. Some of the other bigger changes that this committee might be interested in is Laura Robison went over to the Oregon Health Authority, and so she was our administrator for the Division of Financial Regulation and our insurance commissioner. And so what we've done is we've started a recruitment on that. It opened on September 1st, and it'll close October 6th. So we plan to have a very big participatory program process with stakeholders and staff, and hoping to have an offer letter by about mid-December for that position and someone in the position by January 1. So in the meantime, we have two deputies for DFR, and so T.K. Keene and John Paul Jones will be stepping up and splitting duties, and as the acting director, I'll retain the insurance commissioner role. So,
welcome.
Thanks. So our 1332 waiver, House Bill 2391 directed DCBS to apply for CMS for a Section 1332 state innovation waiver. The 1332 of the Affordable Care Act permits you to diverge from or waive some of the ACA provisions. 1332 waivers can't undermine the comprehensive benefits, affordability of the programs, or consumer protections of the ACAs. So our application asks that the single risk pool requirement of the ACA apply only to the extent necessary to implement a state reinsurance program. If approved, the reinsurance program will reimburse individual health insurers for a portion of the costs of their higher cost enrollees. By operating this program, we expect to help stabilize the individual market, leading to lower individual market premiums. So as required by the application process, DCBS gave public notice of the application and allowed opportunity for public input. The comment period was open from July 25th to August 25th. We held public meetings on August 24th and 25th, and we also consulted with the Oregon tribes. We submitted our application on October 31st, and we've actually already received notice back from CMS that the application was complete. And then that letter was dated September 11th, and that marks their process. It's a 180-day federal decision-making process. Their comment period is open now and will be open until October 11th. And assuming the waiver is approved, DCBS will establish a reinsurance program through their administrative rulemaking process. It'll include defining the details that are important to our stakeholders, such as the coinsurance rate, reinsurance cap, and the payment process.
Yes, Senator Stanley.
Thank you. Ms. Strait, welcome. Nice to have you here with us. A couple of questions, if I might, and with Madam Chair's indulgence. 180 days is the minimum, the maximum? What are other states hearing?
It's the maximum.
Okay. Have other states, what's been the track record with other states? Because other states have applied for these waivers.
Sure. Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Steiner Hayward. So there's several states.
Name for the record, Rick.
Thank you. for the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, the policy manager with the Division of Financial Regulation. So there other states that have pursued waivers is Alaska, California, Hawaii, Minnesota, Oklahoma, and Vermont. So Vermont has actually is marked incomplete, and California's was withdrawn. But Alaska, Hawaii, Minnesota, and Oklahoma are still moving forward, along with Oregon. So
nobody's has been approved yet?
Alaska has, yes.
Okay. All right. And then the second piece of the question is, if that waiver has not yet been approved, I should know the answer to this, and I don't. The 2018 plan year rates reflect or do not reflect the decreases that we anticipate, assuming the reinsurance pool?
They do.
They do.
They took that into consideration.
Okay. And if all heck breaks loose and the administration doesn't approve our waiver?
Well, we'll be working with the carriers and trying to see what we have available to us through rule and through the law to be able to accommodate that and work with them.
Thank you.
Okay. So that was about it on that one. So we're talking next about the 2018 health insurance marketplace plans and the rate review. So real quick, the individual market, we approved 7 companies for the marketplace. The average changes in the rates were a 1.6% decrease to a 14.8% increase. Some of the reasons for the rate changes include the cost of providing care. It exceeds the premium collected for many carriers. The federal weakening of the individual mandate. Increase in medical costs driven by utilization. And then the Oregon Reinsurance Program, so what we were just talking about, helped reduce it on an average by 6%. So in the small group market, we approved 9 companies, and their rates increased an average of 3.3% and 10.1%. And the reasons for those changes are similar to the individual market. So
great. Thank you.
All right.
And any complaints so far? I haven't heard any in it.
I haven't heard any.
Usually I will hear them.
So the COFA Oral Health Program Report. So Senate Bill 147 required DCBS to develop recommendations for a program to cover oral health care costs for low-income COFA Oregonians. So we convened an advisory group. They met in person twice over the summer, and the group included COFA community members, oral health experts, and enrollment assisters. DCBS staff and the staff of the Oregon Health Authority and the advisory group looked at 3 potential models for the COFA dental program. The Oregon Health Plans Managed Care Dental Benefits, the Oregon Health Plans Fee-for-Service Open Card Dental Coverage Plan, and a program relying on commercial dental plans. After review and discussion, the advisory group preferred either of the 2 Oregon Health Plans benefit models. The plans don't require patients to pay out of pocket and then request reimbursement. There were concerns that a reimbursement model might prevent barriers to care for the patients. So staff did work on gathering cost comparisons under each program, but was unable to produce reliable comparisons because there's not enough information out there on the private plans cost-sharing model. But the report was submitted on Friday, and what the group recommended is that there actually needs to be a little more study done, go out and collect a little more information. So what they're proposing is doing an RFP to go out and get the demographic study do an RFI of dental providers to get knowledge of how interested they might be, and also to get some costs about what the claims out-of-pocket costs are, and then come back with a more detailed recommendation.
Yes, Senator Byer.
So what's your sense on timing? Will you be able to make a recommendation before the 19th session?
Yes, June 2018 is where they're saying they might be able to come back with that RFP and RFI information with more detailed.
Okay.
Thank
you.
And that's it.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. That's it. All right. All right, before people leave, Lee, can you just, that's all right. I'll wait until after the next one. Okay, let's go ahead to the Oregon Behavioral Health Collaborative. Royce Boylan, Mary Monet, Ermanet, and Kevin Fitz.
Mm-hmm. Good morning. My name is Royce Bullen. I am the Behavioral Health Director for Oregon Health Authority. We are still waiting for our other two guests to show up, so I'm going to go ahead and get started. So you may already know that the Behavioral Health Collaborative started back in July of 2016 and ended in January of 2017. And that process included close to 50 different stakeholders from across the state, including tribal representatives, Department of Education, Department of Corrections. We had a judge, CMHPs, providers, so a whole slew of individuals who came together with the idea of developing recommendations for moving Oregon's behavioral health work forward. That includes integration, includes care coordination, and really fine-tuning our services in the behavioral health field. And when I talk about behavioral health, I'm talking about both mental health and addictions. So what I'm going to cover today is the overview. I'm going to cover the accountability structure, the workgroup deliverables, and provide status updates for those workgroups, timeline and communication plan, and, of course, if there are any questions that you may have. So we, as a group, and when I say we, I was actually part of the Behavioral Health Collaborative as a provider before I started at OHA. So as a group, we came up with four high-level recommendations, one around governance and finance, and we'll get to more detail about these specific recommendations. Standards of care and competencies, workforce, and information in care coordination of care. So the governance and finance work group, they started probably back in June, and they were a group that actually started during the Behavioral Health Collaborative because the 50 members wanted this group to provide more clarification about governance and finance. So their job was to define what we're calling a single point of shared accountability and to define the elements of that as well as a single plan of shared accountability. So the single point is really the convening of members, and the plan is the accountability and what they're going to focus on. So they completed that work on August 31st, and what we're doing now is we're sharing that document with other key stakeholders in the tribes. What they're going to continue working on is identifying incentives and risk sharing and risk and benefit sharing opportunities, as well as ensuring alignment of contracts. So this group of probably about 15, 20 individuals included CMHPs, CCOs, providers. We had tribal representation and consumer representation on this group. So we decided in order to form this single point of shared accountability, we would take a four-phased approach. The first phase is really the convening of the stakeholders. So that's, you know, it's this collective collective impact model where if you pull together a group of just, you know, so we can contractually require CCOs, CMHPs, local public health to convene this group. But what we need is we need Department of Human Services and their various departments. We need Department of Education, corrections, anything that hospitals, CCOs, all of that group and providers and consumers in order to really focus on what priorities are needed for their community. So not Oregon-wide, although there's a lot of common priorities across Oregon, for example, housing, but what are they going to do to specifically develop and improve their behavioral health system? So that would be the first part of the phase is they need to submit to OHA this letter of intent describing who they're bringing together and who the convener of that group is, because we need one person who's going to be in charge of bringing people together, providing the letter of intent, and really organizing that group. And again, for us, that's either the CCO, the CMHP, or local public health. And then the next step is for them to look at, not create, but look at existing reports, data, that talk about behavioral health needs, again, Oregon-wide, maybe across the country, but also what is specific in their community. So we're not asking for them to do another assessment. We're asking them to pull together the data and information that they already have that's existing to use to develop these priorities and the rationale for those priorities. And then the next step is really providing us the action plan. So they've developed their priorities. They've submitted those to OHA. We've approved those priorities. And then they have to figure out how they're going to measure and accomplish those priorities. And then the final phase is really us monitoring the performance of these plans and the reporting of these plans and providing feedback and TA with each of the communities around these plans. A couple of things I'd like to highlight. We had a lot of discussion within that group around being overly prescriptive, and so that would be more around the process, and instead we focused on the outcomes and what they're going to accomplish. We think that localities know what's best for their communities, and we think that they know how to bring those different entities to the table.
And I have heard that, at least with the matrix, that, I mean, it's all across the board right now amongst the CCOs from what I've heard, but I haven't really analyzed all of the CCO data. But I think it's important that the matrix, and I don't know how much input you're going to be giving into the contracts with each CCO, that we start looking at the real integration of behavioral health, mental health in the matrix, but then the process, because each community, I think, is quite different.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair, members of the committee, I would agree with that. What we are doing is looking at all of the metrics and requirements that we require of CCOs, CMHPs, providers, and looking at figuring out how do we align those metrics, but also are they meaningful metrics? We collect a lot of data. Some of it's required of us due to the funding. But honestly, some of the data that we collect is not necessarily meaningful or doesn't tell the whole story. So it's really fine-tuning what metrics we're going to require and making sure that they're meaningful.
Yes, Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you. Director Boland, I'm pleased to hear that things are moving along. As you know, we put a budget note in the OHA budget requiring that you keep reporting back to us during the 2018 session with the plan basically to be able to implement these at the beginning of 2019. Mm-hmm. Do you have confidence that, I mean, obviously there's slop in processes, but and these are complicated because they involve real people, mm-hmm. but do you have reasonable confidence that this process that you've set up will accomplish the goals expected of you from the budget note?
Chair Manas Andersons, Vice Chair, members of the committee, I do believe that we're going to make significant progress. We may not make significant progress across the state, but I believe there are parts of the state, like the Bend area, the Eastern Oregon, the Tri-County area. I believe there are pockets of areas that are ready to do this and may already have community organizations ready to do this. So whether or not all of them will be stood up by that deadline, to be honest, I don't think they all will be, but I think that they will have made progress towards that.
Okay, and a quick other question. You were discussing metrics with the chair. One of the things that I think we've done well with the CCOs is to have our metrics be actually patient-centered mm-hmm. and outcomes that matter, right? Not are you tracking this or that,
exactly.
but real outcomes. And I think that's something that we've been lacking in our behavioral health system. Is that what you're alluding to, is trying to regroup on the metrics to get things? I mean, I don't really care how many people are being, I mean, I do care at some level how many being treated by addiction programs. I care a lot about the outcomes of those programs, mm-hmm. right? We need to be sure that we're spending our money on programs that actually benefit the people seeking care through those programs. So is that the kind of thing you're talking about doing?
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair, members of the of the committee, yes, that's exactly what we're doing. One of the work groups is what we're calling the data work group, and they're about to form. And the idea is that we will provide a menu of options of meaningful metrics that are patient client centered for the metrics and scoring later to select from. I definitely, you're right. We collect a lot of metrics. We collect a lot of data. Whether or not it's meaningful is something that we need to look at.
Thank you.
So one of the other work group is called the Standards of Care and Competency Work Group. They completed on the 31st core competencies for providers, specifically behavioral health providers, and they also looked at other points of entry. We know that not everybody just walks into a behavioral health clinic to receive services. They may have contact with a teacher. They may have contact with their priest or their pastor, the ER, all these other areas where they have contact, and clearly they have behavioral health needs. So we've established standards for the behavioral health workforce. We've also looked again at other points of entry and trying to see how we can impact those other points of entry, knowing that people just don't walk into a behavioral health center all the time. What they're going to be working on over the next couple of months is establishing minimum standards of care, stateside standards for assessment, placement, and billing criteria. They're also looking at the standards for care coordination, and we'll be making recommendations for those. What we heard a lot from the collaborative and from providers and from clients is that the coordination doesn't always happen, and it doesn't always happen in their best interest. And so what can we do to establish some core evidence-based best practice standards to ensure that that does happen?
Is there a way for where it is working well that the CCOs are given information about how other areas like the Wind Rivers has great coordination, evidently, in dental and as well as behavioral health? Is there a venue where CCOs can learn about that or not?
Yeah, a lot of the care, what I'm finding is care coordination is a number of different factors. And Mary Monnet, the executive director, CEO of LifeWorks, can probably talk a little bit about that if you want as well. Is that it's not only sharing data and information, for example, when somebody goes to the emergency room, but it's also what providers share. So providers all have their own attorneys, they all have their own compliance officers, and so there's many different ways in how we look at sharing and exchanging information. So we are looking at what's currently happening, what are the best models, how to reproduce that, and then also how we can improve our health information exchange, and then how we can improve an understanding around sharing of information.
Thank you.
Anything else to add to that?
No, I just think a key piece.
Say your name for the record.
Excuse me. Mary Monnet, LifeWorks Northwest. Senator Monis Anderson, members of the committee. I think one of the exciting parts of this is we talked about the collaboratives will share together and maybe have a kind of practice learning community together so that we can make sure we're all building together and share best practices across the state around that.
So within their work, again, they've endorsed standards using SAMHSA and also using the University of Colorado's information. They've done a lot of research across the states. Again, minimum standards for assessment, placement, level of care, and billing criteria. And, of course, how to establish the minimum standards for care coordination, but also how to pay for it. So the WorkFirst Work Group, who works really closely with the Oregon Health Policy Board Healthcare Workforce Committee, their deliverables were to recommend recruitment and retention strategies specific to the behavioral health workforce. And then for the next 2 months, they'll be working on standards for, again, the well-trained workforce, inclusive of certified licensed and licensed peer support specialists, community health workers throughout the state. We've also engaged into or entered into a relationship with the Farley Center to collect or to begin a workforce assessment, again, related to behavioral health. What we're asking them to do is identify the need, identify where we have behavioral health workers, identify the gaps, and then help us to develop recommendations around retention and recruitment of behavioral health staff. Because we know that there's a significant turnover in the community mental health programs around our behavioral health staff. We're also looking at loan repayment programs and seeing what existing resources we have to leverage, outreach efforts, and then training around making sure that staff have the tools in order to do their job and feel competent about what they're doing. So I'm going to turn this over to Kevin Fitz, who will talk about the Peer Delivered Services Work Group.
Please, Madam Chair, one more quick
yes.
question, if
yeah.
I can. Thank you. I'm sorry. One of the things that we did through the Public Safety Subcommittee was direct the Criminal Justice Commission to do an assessment of addiction treatment programs that help serve people who have been interacting with the criminal justice system. Obviously, there's some overlap.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, we also did things to help decriminalize or at least lower the penalties on certain property crimes and change from felony to misdemeanor for possession of a controlled substance for small amounts of controlled substances, because we recognize that most of those relate to substance misuse disorders.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about whether you're going to be coordinating on the metrics and assessments and things, because it seems kind of silly to have two state agencies doing the same work? Obviously, there are some programs that don't treat people who are involved in the criminal justice system, some that just treat people, but criteria are criteria, mm-hmm. and success is success. So are you coordinating with Mr. Schmidt and his team at all?
Chair Mona Sandersons, Vice Chair, members of the committee. Yes, so OHA is working closely with CJC around that report, and where there's alignment, we will look for that. And
great. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Senator Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Fitz. I'm the director of the Oregon Mental Health Consumer Association. And if I just want to give a shout out, I want to give a shout out to Senator Jeff Cruz. He was the keynote speaker of the largest peer consumer conference on the West Coast in 2000. He was our keynote speaker at Voices of Hope. He took his tie off. The crowd was cheering. It was just amazing.
That's a really scary thought.
Yeah. He was a real crowd pleaser. He's got a real knack for this political stuff, I think. I knew that 17 years ago. And then I just want to give a shout out to Senator Hayward. Her support of Alliance for Life and her commitment to working with folks who have disabilities and giving a voice to them. I really appreciate that. So again, my name is Kevin Fitz. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Mental Health Consumer Association. I was also a consumer representative on Director Saxon's Behavioral Health Collaborative on the subcommittee of the workforce. So I had some prepared notes and just want to sort of tell you what these are. So the Peer Delivered Services Core Team. So within Oregon Health Authority, there are folks that do leadership and policy and advocacy from the position of peers to reach out to peers and consumers and recipients. They had an internal meeting where they were meeting once every month and discussing issues relevant to the consumer movement and peers. As the as the Behavioral Health Collaborative finished and Director Saxton and Director Boylan were hearing such issues, they decided, why don't we expand that internal peer council and include some more peer stakeholders to look at some of these issues around the Behavioral Health Collaborative peer initiatives. And so they put together three different groups, and I'm just going to give you a highlight of what those three different work groups came up with as recommendations to the Behavioral Health Collaborative Steering Committee. And here they are. So the first committee was the Peer Delivered Services System Standards Group. Peer Delivered Services programs, standards, values, and principles should apply to all peer delivered services in Oregon. Secondly, monitoring for effective and appropriate use of employing peer services should be included in the Health Systems Division site review process, and the process should include the use of representatives of the peer delivered services workforce as peer reviewers. I'll submit this this written piece to the committee so they can have it. The second group, the peer delivered services standardized training model. We sure use the word peer an awful lot in these talking points. Number one, peer delivered services core team recommends continuing with existing training standards and certification process, which is administered by the OHA Office of Equity and Inclusion. Secondly, under that standardized training model, peer delivered services core team does not recommend the implementation of a practicum prior to certification, as programs would not be able to bill Medicaid during a practicum. So I thought that was a particularly interesting distinction. And finally, peer delivered services supervision. And this was, and I was actually on, participated in lots of these, and this was a lot of discussion. There is a sense in the idea of fidelity in the peer and consumer movement that if you are somebody who's working in a designated position as a consumer advocate or as a peer, is that the ideal sense is that you would have somebody who was a peer as your manager. And so what we looked at was, well, maybe we could suggest, instead of maybe mandating 100%, maybe we might want to suggest that 50% you get co-supervision. For example, in Multnomah County, the Multnomah County Behavioral Health Department hired two peers. They are directly supervised by the deputy mental health director. The deputy mental health director does not publicly identify as a peer nor with her position. So she has contracted out with a consumer peer agency to do co-supervision of these two peers. So that's just sort of a general idea of kind of, well, you know, how do we move forward? What is working? So here they are, peer delivered services supervision. Establish standards and qualifications for peer delivered services supervisors. Secondly, peer delivered services supervision should be contracted with peer-run organizations if the program does not have a qualified peer delivered services supervisor. So that was the example I was telling you about Multnomah County. Senator Hayward, did you have a question?
Just a minute. I am just wondering if when these peer delivered services, this is what types of patients or individuals are they working with?
So if you are, since the creation of the expansion of Medicaid and Obamacare came into Oregon, the creation of Oregon Health Authority, they created the Traditional Health Workers Commission, which actually does the training, certification, and continuing educational units for certified peers. So you go through a training course to actually get it. You apply for certification.
What kind of patients are they seeing? I mean, to me, some mental health conditions probably shouldn't have peer supports. So I just need to know.
Okay. So you're familiar with the phrase social determinants of health. So as a peer, in these particular positions, peer support specialist, peer wellness specialist, certified recovery mentor, these are not clinical diagnostic counselor positions. These are supportive These are supportive, social supports, community supports, information or referral supports. So for clinical work, you work with your psychiatrist and your mental health professional around diagnostic treatment issues, medication, therapy, that sort of thing. But for the day-to-day, where the tire hits the road on the pavement, connecting with other services around all the other needs around health, around primary health, around housing, around benefits, around employment, that's what peers, that's what peers do. But also, too, I should tell you, there are some individuals that identify as peers. Like, for example, there's a gentleman who ran the Oregon Mental Health Department for 10 years. He was actually the mental health commissioner, but he also identifies as somebody who lives with serious clinical depression. But in the actual role of what the Oregon Health Authority and the behavioral health providers are employing peers to do in under their certification is to do supportive services, information referral services, networking services, social needs, that sort of thing. So, yes, so that's a very important point to make. And we like to say, you know, with proper training, folks with the lived experience of mental health and addictions could just do just about anything. But under this particular issue, it is around the social determinants of health and helping support. We've actually found in some places in rural and frontier Oregon where the county mental health director has had a shortage of qualified mental health professionals, that what have they've actually done to take some of the work that the qualified mental health professional that wasn't counseling and diagnostic work, helping fill out forms, helping connect John to other services in the community, that peers can actually take some of that workload for them to be able to concentrate on the ever-growing role that they have as a qualified mental health professional. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
So that's happened. That's actually happened in Benton County, and that's happened in Southern Oregon and Eastern Oregon.
Senator Steiner-Harris.
Thank you. I think the corollary is when you're talking about the supervision piece, Mr. Fitz, say somebody identifies publicly as dealing with schizoaffective disorder and is well controlled, you know, through appropriate therapy, and is in the kind of position where they could be serving in a supervisory position. We have peer support through ESA and stuff like that for young people in particular who've been recently diagnosed with similar disorders. And could that person also serve as a peer supervisor for people who are certified drug and alcohol counselors, for example? How closely does the matching have to be, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask. Because I need to be confident at some level. I agree with you, right? You should be supervised by somebody who understands the work you're doing and understands the services and the people that you're serving, right? I completely agree with that. I guess the question is how granular are we going to get with this?
So I don't know if it's completely detailed, but if you ask the folks who work particularly in addiction issues, they'd say we would like the person who is doing the peer supervision to be a certified recovery mentor under our certification process. And if you're working in behavioral health delivery, the ideal is that you will be certified as a peer support specialist or a peer wellness specialist. So initially we had, am I running out of time? Initially, we had certified recovery mentor and peer support specialist. What peer wellness specialist is, it's twice the amount of initial hours to get a certification. The idea of that birthed from the idea that the peer wellness specialist would get a background in understanding behavioral health issues, but also in connecting with primary care services. So that sort of that connection. Unfortunately, the system is just sort of getting the word out there of what peer wellness specialist is, how that differentiates. But we think that this opportunity is going to grow and grow and grow, particularly when we look at the challenges of maybe declining revenue and cutting budgets and what produces good income, what produces good outcomes at the end. And there is, and I was talking to Director Monnet on the way here, there is nobody who is against free ice cream. There is nobody in the community who is against the idea of peer services or the idea that they produce better systems of natural systems of support, or better, you know, my friend Peter Davidson, the psychiatrist, said public mental health should be like a utility, should be like a bus. You get it on at a point A and you get off it at point B. You don't stay at one high level of utilization the rest of your life. If so, we're not doing our job. We do a fantastic job with the psychiatric crisis. I mean, with given our resources and our communication issues, we do a great job at the front end with psychiatric crisis issues. But at the back end of building a back door or an outdoor to the community, to rehabilitation, to lessen our connection or a need for great services, we seem to miss that in the crisis or the fire of the day. So just let me read this last 2 points and then I'll be done. Peer delivered service, provide here, the last one under PDS services, provide training and technical assistance about integrating peer delivered services. So those were our three particular points. And I also just want to give a shout out. I know that we've gone through changes. Director Royce Boland has hit the ground running since he's taken this job. He has been very encouraging, accommodating, and I have listened to him with folks that are very assertive and very diplomatic and other folks that are just, just a little bit more colorful, but he is building a broad tent and encouraging all voices. He has said numerous times, call me, send me a text, let me know what's going on. And also under his staff, Mike Morris, who's the director of policy underneath him, has done a great job. And so I just want to say we get tremendous encouragement from the Oregon Health Authority, behavioral health staff, and leadership around our issues. Sometimes, they would like us to not gallop, maybe trot once in a while with some of our ambitions, but Rome wasn't built in a day. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So another work group, which is working closely with the Oregon Health Policy Board, Health Information Technology Oversight Committee. Their deliverables are to advance the implementation of technology to, again, further coordination across the system or across the state and specifically in behavioral health, identify ways the state and the collaborations for the state and the way and the regional collaborations to support the continued adoption of EHRs and, again, sharing information across systems. So what's been really great about this work is the Behavioral Health Collaborative recommendations really fit nicely within what HITOC is doing. And so recently they completed a environmental scan of health information technology used by the behavioral health agencies across the state. They're still looking at the results and soon should have the results out. They're also underway of conducting key interviews with tribes and other behavioral health providers. In December, the HITOC committee will review the report. Identify gaps and opportunities and additional recommendations for supporting behavioral health around health information exchange and EMRs and EHRs. We also heard a lot from collaborative members around, because a lot of what we talked about was Medicaid and general fund and those kinds of things. But they really wanted to have a conversation about private insurance and a parity within the private insurance. So what we've done, and we were lucky, is that OHA and DCBS are working together on a parity academy that they've joined through SAMHSA. And then OHA will continue to work with DCBS and commercial payers to identify our collective authority to integrate commercial, publicly insured behavioral health efforts to produce results, efficiencies, and parities. I'd also like to note Senate Bill 860, which provided DCBS with $600,000 to review insurer payments to determine if they're adopting or complying with mental health parity. This is the work group I was talking about earlier. This work group is tied to the Health Plan Quality Metrics Committee. And again, what they're focused on is looking at outcomes and metrics that are client-focused, moves our services in the right direction towards integration, aligns outcome measurements and standards for behavioral health, And again, OHA is working with its current systems to coordinate information and track progress and outcomes across the state. We've heard a lot that we have a lot of metrics and outcomes. So again, we are looking at figuring out a way to streamline those or to align those with other work. The work group will submit recommendations to the Health Plan Quality Metrics Committee for the metrics to hold the CCOs accountable. The Transformation Center, based on some of the recommendations, have started working on a series of webinars, specifically around data sharing, organizing local structures around shared outcomes, so that collective impact, blending funding models, using data to improve the services, ensuring equity and transparency within the governance model. And then we're working on a one-day event around hiring, retention, and using peer-delivered services. So I'm happy to say that we are in phase four of the implementation timeline. We have the work groups have submitted about 70 to 80% of all their work. We're looking at the governance and finance and standard of care and competencies. Again, they're continuing their work. And then the data work group, again, will begin in October and will complete by December. What we've done is we've taken those deliverables and we're shopping those around to various groups to make sure that we've been inclusive, we've heard everybody's voice, and then those recommendations will go to the steering committee, who will ultimately make the decision on which priorities that we will move forward. So I mentioned earlier, we have the steering committee, which is set up, and they're really responsible for making sure that this work moves forward. We're in the process of developing the core team, so those will be OHA staff, DHS staff, cross-sectional, cross-organizational staff, who will really be the ones who implement the work and move it forward. We're currently looking at contract changes for the CCOs and the CMHPs and also local public health. And then we're also looking at any Oregon administrative rule changes that may be needed. If we have a second, I'd like to turn it over to Mary Mona to give a provider's perspective of this work. Mary's been heavily involved in the governance and finance work group. So if we have time, if that.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Senator Moines Anderson, members of the committee. I apologize for our traffic delays. I know that would be another committee today, but I would love to speak just quickly about the provider perspective on this. To be honest, when I first got called to be part, I said, here we go again, another plan, and kind of approached it with open mind, and I will say through the course of this year have become increasingly compelled that we have to do this. Our provider system, as you all well aware, we are under siege. We face increased demand with more complex consumers who have not just chronic and serious mental illness and addiction issues, but also chronic health conditions. We have decreasing workforce, again, because our wages are so substandard based on rates that don't cover the true cost of care. And like I say, more people, the good news is more people than ever are turning for help, I think in part due to reduced stigma and more access. So those are good things, but it's created a challenge, I think, for all communities. What's to me compelling about the Behavioral Health Collaborative is it is, if you will, system coordination. We talk about care coordination for our consumers and how important that is. We also need, scarce resources to pull our systems together so that we're all lined up on the same page. And I think the collaborative offers that opportunity for each unique community. I personally work in an area where we have two CCOs. They're fabulous. Full disclosure, I sit on the board of one of them. But again, we're all doing good work at the CCO level, the three counties. But again, you think about multiple school districts, health departments, ESDs, criminal justice, to Senator Steinert Hayward's point, we all have to align those resources because none of us alone can do this work. And I think the ability to really have that single shared point of accountability where we have the same goals and can collectively work toward those. I think providers welcome the opportunity to see that alignment and to play as important a role as we can. And most importantly, and Kevin's not sitting here anymore, but the consumers are who have to be at the heart and center of this. We've had great success in involving peers in the delivery of our care and informing our policy, and that needs to continue. Again, the consequences are too dire. We see that playing out in all our systems. So I was a reluctant dragon, perhaps, in the beginning, but I'm full on board. And, of course, always the devil's in the details as we roll this forward. But I think providers are happy and willing to do anything to improve the care and situation for those we serve.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Before we go to the next informational hearing, I just want to remind everyone that on November 21st, our LC requests have to be in. And so then January 8th is when they are returned. So I would like to know, we have, I think, one committee bill. We have one of the three already taken that the committee bills. I think that'll be the concussion bill, not for sure. But if any of you need or have ideas, I wish you would let Cassie know what healthcare-related bills that you have. Senators?
I've got one that I'd like to talk with you about.
Okay. So if you have anything, let me know. You guys out there, let me know. Appreciate that. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, let's move on to alternative models for behavioral and mental health. And there are three different panels. So shall we start at the top?
We can.
Okay. Chris Ferentinos, Royce Boylan, and...
It's just Chris.
Just Chris to begin with.
Oh.
Okay, so let's start. Then the next panel is Royce Boylan, Mary Monette.
Oh, no, she's right there.
Oh, Chris Boylan? Okay, why don't you come on forward first?
Ferentinos.
Chris Ferentinos.
Hello. Good morning. My name is Chris Ferentinos. I am the Vice President for Unity Center for Behavioral Health, which is this collaboration between Legacy, OHSU, Adventist, and Kaiser, operated by Legacy, that we just opened in January this year. And I'm here to do a little bit of an update on it to you all. So since we opened, I think we have really shown a significant progress against the mission that we had set out to create a pathway to hope, community, and recovery. We served more than 5,000 patients up to this point, about 1,500 of those in the inpatient side and the rest in the psychiatric emergency service. Unity Center...
In the
inpatient, about 1,500, and 5,000 as a whole. We don't admit patients directly into our inpatient, other than in the pediatric unit. The pediatric unit that we have, all of the patients come through the psychiatric emergency service for an evaluation first, because the whole idea is to be able to see if we can stabilize and return the person to the community and avoid an avoidable hospitalization and divert the patient from that hospitalization. We truly think that the Unity Center has shown that we can treat those having a mental health emergency more quickly and efficiently than traditional hospital emergency rooms. So one of the tenets of our approach is trauma-informed care. I don't know if you know what that is, but basically it's really looking at the effects of trauma in individuals that have a longstanding mental health issue, addiction issue, and really looking at how to not re-traumatize the person and to be able to start a pathway to healing. So we were definitely designed as that pathway to healing. So we created a very interactive healing environment where psychiatrists, psychiatric nurse practitioners, social workers, nurses, and peer support specialists interact one-on-one with the patients. If you ever came to visit us, you would see something that you probably have never seen in your life, because our psychiatric emergency service is this big, large room, about three times the size of this room here, with recliners, where psychiatrists, nurses, peers, and social workers are interacting with the patients. Sometimes it's hard to tell who is who. It's really an idea of being very patient-centered and just people taking care of people. And I think for that reason, the environment is so much more conducive to healing. Now, of course, for some patients that do not withstand, cannot withstand the open milieu, the open environment, we do have some calming rooms in the back of the big room. And then we also have hold rooms for individuals that are struggling so much that they need to be on a hold in a seclusion for a little bit until they can be able to be in the larger milieu. We're open 24/7. We have available psychiatrists, social workers, nurses, and around the clock. And I think that the peer support specialist programs that we have created are pretty unique. We have two programs. We have one that is the peers in the PES, so it's the peers that are actually in the psychiatric emergency service and that offer that sort of heart-to-heart conversation about the struggles, because they are people in recovery themselves. So that there's that message of hope. I think medicine, I mean, I'm a physician myself, medicine is something that we look normally about the symptoms, what's wrong with the person, right? Like what diagnosis, etc. And I think peer support really come around that and present the aspect of the hope and of the recovery. Our peers in the past have served more than 700 individuals in over 1,200 hours of direct service already. We also have a peer bridger program. In your handout, it's not in there, but the peer bridger program is aimed at helping individuals that struggle with follow-up, struggle with continuity of care, and they can follow a patient in the community up to 45 days after discharge to be able to provide that kind of support for the person to follow up and basically connect with the supports that they need. I think the transitions of care approach that Unity Center has been able to create, it's probably one of the most unique aspects of what we have done. Hospitals normally work pretty isolated from the rest of the community, and we planned for 2 years before we opened to be completely permeable, if you will, to be this very fluid membrane between us and the community. So we have co-locators, we have people from the from treatment centers in the community that co-locate with us, that literally work with us every day. Folks from Care Oregon, from Family Care, LifeWorks Northwest, Cascadia Behavioral Health, Western Psychological, Central City Concern, NARA, DePaul Treatment Centers, both co-locating or using a model that we call InReach. So whenever the patient arrives there, they can come to help with that handoff. Now, early results show that in the first quarter of 2017, 88.9% of the patients who discharged from our inpatient units attended their next outpatient appointment within 7 days from discharge. I'm talking about attended, not got scheduled. Got scheduled is about 95%. This is data from the state. Another few milestones that I would like to share with you is that Unity Center has been serving in the psychiatric emergency service about 30 patients a day. And they arrive by ambulance, police, walk-in, transfers from other hospital emergency rooms, etc. 30% of the patients cared for at Unity say that they are homeless or living in shelters. I would say that another 20% for sure have house instability as an issue. On average, Patients who need to move to an inpatient bed at Unity are in the psychiatric emergency service between 15 and 20 hours. So I want to point out that before we opened Unity, we had data on boarding time in emergency rooms throughout our systems, and I'll say it was between 40 and 60 hours. So boarding time is really the time between being deemed that that person needs a bed and getting that bed. So it's that person sitting in the emergency room with the locked door, you know, with nothing to do and no therapy. And so that comparison, I think it's relevant, because when a person shows up and they need a bed, they wait for that bed between 15 and 20 hours. So it's not that much in comparison. Also, and this is, I think it's one of the biggest highlights for you, we are able to discharge 77% of the patients that show up in the psychiatric emergency service within 20 hours of stabilization. 77% of the people. So we're really focusing on using the beds that we have for the individuals who really, truly need. It's the whole idea of the triple aim, really, to be able to do the best care for the best cost with the best patient experience. So this is what I wanted to show you. I think and I can imagine that you guys have the papers that were sent to you, right? The other thing that I wanted to just point out is that we were featured in the advisory board, which is a large consulting firm for healthcare, as the right-sizing ED utilization for acute behavioral health patients. And this whole idea of utilizing an emergency, a dedicated psychiatric emergency service to be able to alleviate what has happened insofar the number of patients with behavioral health issues that show up in emergency rooms. It has become their safety net. And a couple other things that I want to say is that we also saw in early results that the fact that we open the psychiatric emergency service has reduced the number of hours that two of our largest hospitals, so Legacy has Emmanuel Medical Center and Good Samaritan. Those two hospitals are very close to Unity, and they have large populations of behavioral health patients that used to show up there in their emergency room. We have been able to reduce the time that those emergency departments were in divert status. Divert status is when I'm so full, I cannot take one more ambulance, right? So we've been able to reduce that divert status time about 70% of the time. So it has been reduced tremendously because now the patients are coming to Unity as opposed to being taken to those hospitals. I think there are still challenges ahead. I think one of the biggest challenges we have is staffing. It's just finding all of the nurses and all of the physicians and all of the nurse practitioners, social workers that we need to have. We're constantly having to hire, and we're in that mode. And definitely also the merging of the cultures. We brought four different hospitals together, and we're still working on creating our own unique Unity culture. People will say, but this is how we did it at Advantage. No, but this is how we do it at OHSU. And so you have that going on. We're still working very hard on that. Well, thank you very much. Any questions?
Do you have a breakdown of the diagnoses of the patients, of the 5,000 patients that you have had?
I do have it, but I don't have it right here. But I
send that to our administrator.
Absolutely, absolutely. But I can tell you that there is a large number of the patients that show up basically with suicidal ideation, depression, anxiety, and then you have the bipolar spectrum, and then the third category is schizoaffective disorders, the whole spectrum.
It'd be nice to know the percentage. And
yes.
And then how many are Medicaid?
62% of the patients that are showing up and then about 20% Medicare, and about 18% commercial, and about 2% non-insured.
And then once you determine that they need a bed, what's the average length of stay for those who need a bed?
That's the 15 to 20 hours. So, for instance, when people and the important part to understand is that the model of the psychiatric emergency service is very different than the model of an emergency a regular emergency medical emergency service, which is normally it's assessment disposition. In our case, it's assessment treatment, because we want to be able to stabilize folks. So assessment treatment, and then within a certain time we go like, okay, this patient is really too ill. We're not going to be able to stabilize them within 23 hours. So by the time we make that determination, between 15 to 20 hours, that patient is in a bed. Does that make sense?
But if they need longer than the 15 to 20 hours, do they stay in the facility that you have, or do you transfer them to another?
No, they stay okay. In the psychiatric emergency service.
Yeah, Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you, Dr. Ferrantinos. This is really all great news, and it's really great to hear it because there was a lot of excitement and promise about unity. Could you please provide the committee at your convenience, you can send them to our analysts, with a little bit more of the metrics that you've got some in your handouts that you've provided us with, but I'd like to see a little bit more
breakdown.
And you've got a lot about the financial implications. I'm very curious about, we have frequent flyers who show up in emergency departments because of behavioral health issues. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing a decrease in return rate because you're getting them into their return visits so quickly? Are you seeing improved utilization of appropriate primary care services? Because we know that historically people with significant behavioral health challenges tend to get their physical health neglected. And I'm curious about those kinds of metrics. Obviously, it's early times yet, but it's clear that you're collecting these data, and I'm curious about understanding those a little bit more.
Yeah, we have a data galore. I mean, we have like metrics in 47 different categories that we're like following, including the revisits within 72 hours.
Right.
And about 10% of the people who leave the psychiatric emergency service are presenting with a revisit within 72 hours. Now, what I want to point out is that our work with all of our partners in the community, we have a high utilization committee both for Family Care and Care Oregon, because those are the two largest Medicaid payers. And what we're doing is we look at every single person, how many visits they have in other emergency departments. And what we're seeing is that some of these folks, they're shifting from going to Emmanuel, for instance, to going to Unity. And so what we're doing is we know these folks, and many of them, they come into the our wait room, and we send a social worker outside. And then we, hi, so-and-so, how are you? What can we do today? What's going on? Oh, do you need a sandwich? Okay. Do you need a voucher? Okay. So a lot of it, it's handling sort of like ahead of time. Mm-hmm. Some of them know that if they say, I'm suicidal, we're going to see them. And rightly so. Now, the connection to primary care is one of our metrics, so that's definitely something that throughout all of the legacy systems, and in fact all of the systems, we're making sure that every single person has a primary care. I do not have a way to tell you if people are attending the primary care. That's something that it's, because this is actually encounter data that the state would have to provide. See what I mean? Like,
yeah, it's, no, I don't understand exactly what you're saying, but I'm looking out at my OHA colleagues in the room saying, okay, guys, let's talk about this a little bit more and try to understand this and whether we're seeing improved utilization of the
exactly.
kinds of other kinds of services that mm-hmm. we know improve people's health and cut costs in the long term.
Yeah, one of the things we have been able to ascertain is that people who go to their 7-day follow-up appointment have 25% less rehospitalization within 30 days. That actually has been ascertained by HealthShare of Oregon.
Okay.
If you'd be kind enough, could just contact me. I'd like to come visit.
So that
if you'd
would be
kind enough to contact
that
my
would
office,
be great.
I'd be grateful.
I would
Thank
be
you.
Delighted.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Royce Boylan, Mary Monette, and Shelley Aurig. And let's try to keep it to about 15 minutes for this panel, and then... Please proceed.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Royce Bullen. I'm the Behavioral Health Director for Oregon Health Authority, and we're here to provide an update on the Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinics. I'm quickly going to give just an overview of the CCBHCs, and then Mary Monette and Shelley Urig, will provide more information about from a provider perspective and how it's going. So this is a two-year demonstration grant that we received that goes started on April 1st of this year and ends on March 31st of 2019. Oregon was one of eight states that was selected for this demonstration grant. The goals are to increase services, increase access to services during the two-year demonstration, and emphasize care coordination and a no-wrong-door approach. This is the CCBHCs are modeled after the federally qualified health centers. We receive an enhanced match for Medicaid services to fund these clinics. Clinics receive a cost-based reimbursement prospective payment system. That's how they get paid. Clinics serve anyone regardless of ability to pay. That includes veterans. High standards for certification, as I'm sure the providers will attest. The clinical model is integration of physical and behavioral health. It's trauma-informed. It's also services that are outside the four walls. A strong emphasis on care coordination. And again, services to all are required. No one can be turned away. We're fortunate in that we have a widespread span across the state of the CCBHCs. So here's just a map to show you where they are. Although we do have 12 organizations that are certified, some organizations have more than one CCBHC. So as I said, I'd like to turn it over to Mary and Shelley to tell you how it's going on the ground. Thank you.
My name is Shelley Urig. I'm the Chief Operations Officer for Options for Southern Oregon. Thank you for allowing me to come and talk about our project and our organization. I just wanted to talk a little bit about our access to services and how we've been able to change. So we now have extended hours. So we are open Monday through Thursday, 8 to 7 for children and 8 to 8 for adults. And on Fridays, 8 to 5. So we have longer extended hours. We've also changed our model of care where a patient used to call in and say, I need an appointment, I'd like to come see you. We've changed to an open access model where the person can come in and be there the day that they want their service and we'll see them and start them. So that we used to have about a 35% no-show rate for new appointments, and that has gone down to about almost nothing. So it's pretty phenomenal. It goes along the principles of really being there when the person needs you. And in order to increase some of our other access, we actually have 66 other access points in the community. We are co-located in all the schools and all the Head Start classrooms. We're in 9 physician offices. We've actually talked to a lot of consumers, and they said, you know, we just don't want to come into your building. So we've really worked on how we can go where the people are and where people need services. So we actually have a private office that we pay for in the community for a therapist. So if somebody just doesn't want to come in, they can access services through that office. Another thing we've done to increase services is we had 18 of our staff members actually retake their licensing exam so that we can serve veterans and be certified to provide TRICARE services. So that was a very large undertaking, but people just were very committed to doing that. Another thing that we've been doing is in our mobile crisis, we're available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we can go anywhere in the community that we're needed. It could be the police department calls us. It could be a doctor's office calls us. And we'll go into the community. One of the things I think that's unique about our program is when we go and see the person in the community, we actually open them to services. So they do not have to take that next step and go in back in and come in and do a full assessment the next day. We actually follow the person. We do a warm handoff over to outpatient, and they're open to services. We follow them for about 45 days. And with our crisis, we also look at our emergency department and hospital usage. We have a pretty robust emergency room follow-up process where anybody that's seen in the emergency room for a behavioral health reason, we actually have they leave with an appointment from the hospital, and we make sure that we do a follow-up. We have about an 84% success rate for our follow-ups, which has reduced ER rates and hospital rates pretty substantially. Some of the other things that we look at to engage consumers is we have a very active peer service delivery department. We have a peer that's on our crisis team or crisis response. We have a peer in every department that really can focus on engagement. Some of the other things that we've also been doing is we have a primary care, we have reverse co-location, so we have a fully integrated star tier 5 primary care medical home, which is a new rating with OHA, so we were able to attain that this year. And I think that's been phenomenal in that our primary care doctor can actually sit on, like, our assertive community treatment team. She can attend meetings in the morning and staffings, and we can do multidisciplinary meetings and really address the whole person, which is huge. I just wanted to read a couple of comments from a recent audit, and one of it was, they helped me find work, housing, and they took care of my health. What more could I want? They make me feel like I matter and that I'm important. So those are some of the comments about just some of our wide range of services we've been able to implement and provide. We have very positive feedback.
One thing I would really like to know is, again, what is the diagnosis breakdown? So, and how many are Medicaid that you're seeing? So if there's any way to get that information, you can share it with Cassandra, who give it.
Thank you. We are primarily Medicaid, so we serve about 80%.
80%.
Yeah.
And then I would really like to know what the breakdown is for the mental health.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you. Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Thank you. This is all really cool, and it's exactly what we're hoping for, and the reverse co-location is exactly the point of these CCBHCs. Director Boland, one of the questions I have for you is, how is the model working to share best practices? Obviously, they're achieving some substantial successes down in Jackson County.
Josephine,
I apologize. I couldn't quite see the map, and I didn't hear it carefully enough. In Josephine County, and I'm curious about how you're planning on sharing best practices, how you're bringing these demonstration projects together to ensure that best practices get disseminated and we take advantage of successful programs like the one Ms. Urich presented.
Chair, Vice Chair, members of the, I always get this wrong.
Don't worry about it.
Thank you. The CCBHCs meet regularly, and they share what's going well, what's not going well, and what are the strategies. Beyond that, I think within OHA, and when we're talking, we are sharing that information. But I think you bring up a good point of how do we, and I don't know if this was your point, how do we disseminate that information past the CCBHCs? I think that's a good question that we want me to think about.
Thank you.
We have about
I promise it'll be super quick.
I guess that one of the points I want to make is some of the things that we're hearing, like, I don't want to walk into your building, I've seen all over the state, right? I mean, we see this with some of the walk-in centers in Clackamas County and the new one that just got us in Washington County. They're set up in such a way that it's not obvious what kinds of services they provide because exactly the kinds of concerns that you raised. And I guess the flip side of that is that what that demonstrates to me is that while there are some things that are community-specific, there are a lot of things that are pretty standard. And we have a tendency sometimes in Oregon to say, yeah, we're different. and I want to be sure that we're not going too far towards, yeah, we're different, when in fact really we're kind of the same, and that that OHA is holding the programs to some extent accountable for trying some of these practices that we know are working or giving a really good reason why they're not trying them and they wouldn't work in their community. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Senator Moynis Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Mary Monnet, LifeWorks Northwest, the CEO. I would love to just say this is, you heard me say I might have been a reluctant dragon in the last testimony. I jumped in with both feet on this because truly it's the biggest investment at the federal level in a generation in finding a new way to both deliver and pay for mental health services and addiction services so it's better integrated with physical health. And I think the key here, it is a demonstration, and it allowed us, quite honestly, at LifeWorks Northwest, we put up 4 clinics, which was a huge endeavor because it meant seriously rethinking our whole way, similar to, I think you heard from my colleague. I basically inherited the model that we've been using for a long time, and this was a chance to step back and say, if you could cost to get the outcomes you want and the care coordination and linkage to primary care to actually improve the lives of our consumers, who we all know die 25 years earlier than others, what would you do? And we focused at LifeWork Northwest. We took those consumers we knew through EDI and pre-managed. Those are this health information exchange that is changing the game, by the way. We were able to see who we had somehow been referred to but never engaged, or if they engaged, they got a very low dose of services at LifeWorks Northwest. That's who we focused our interventions on. We said if we could, because at some level they got referred to us, figure out a model to better engage those. So that's where we went for community engagement specialists, peer wellness specialists. We designed a rapid response team. When the ER calls us or Unity, we can respond right away and get those consumers engaged in care. I want to be clear, it's a tall lift. The other thing it allowed is to cost the services. This will be no surprise to you all, but the services are not paid for at the rates that really deserve the kind of rates we need to get the quality to serve the people. So our teams are phenomenal in the conditions they work in and the wages they're paid. As far as I'm concerned, anyone who works in behavioral health and addiction, they're saints. And this allowed us to not get all the way to where we need to go, but it does allow us to pay a better wage. And we told our whole team, because not all of LifeWorks Northwest staff is on that pay wage, this was big for us, is to say we feel like this is so important that we are going to take this, you know, these 4 clinics out of our 20-some and try this new model. So it took a lot of buy-in, a lot of organizational change. The health screening and monitoring services that now each of these 4 clinics, by the way, one in Gresham, one in Beaverton, love to have you come and visit us, senators. Okay. And the pharmacy. So what it did at LifeWorks Northwest, I felt like we've been pioneers in integration, to be honest, since 2002 when we started putting our services in Virginia Garcia Neighborhood Health Center, Wallace, some of the other health clinics. And we also had primary care at LifeWorks. But what this did is it made us realize to our own degree we'd become siloed in our own services. If you came in for child and family, you sat here. If you came in for serious mental illness, you went over here. And those teams didn't meet. Now we took a whole different approach. We said these consumers all sit now on integrated teams so that they're talking together. Our own people are getting better linkage. And so I just would highlight care coordination needs to happen even within our current system, not just to our peer organizations.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Ajit Jitmalani and Terry Peterson.
Peterson. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, I'm Ajit Jetmalani. I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist, and I'm director of child psychiatry at OHSU. I also am a consultant to Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here to present with Dr. Terry Pedersen. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Good morning, Chair. I'm Monis Anderson and the committee. My name is Dr. Terry Pedersen. I'm a pediatrician by training. It's been my honor to work with Opal K since its inception and to be a participant of the recent ECHO project for child psychiatry.
Opal K came out of actually a... I'm glad that wasn't me. Thank you.
It was me.
Opal K came out of a collaboration between... Oregon Pediatric Society, Oregon Council of Child Psychiatry, OHSU Division of Child Psychiatry, and Oregon Family Support Network. We formed a mental health task force 12 years ago to try and find ways to improve access to care in the medical home, the primary care medical home for children. And the legislature, in its wisdom in 2013, funded this project, and it's had an extraordinary impact, I think, and we want to share details of the project as well as some of the offshoots that have come from having that infrastructure, and then talk about Project ECHO. The Opal K project is a consortium effort between OPS, OHSU, and OCAP, Oregon Council of Child Psychiatry. It's a mostly hot call, so a primary care will call in from their office with a concern about a child and family, and they will receive care from a child psychiatrist immediately or within minutes of their call most of the time. And this service is a approach that implements what we would call biopsychosocial review of a child's story. So we ask the primary care to present the story. We talk about biological, psychological, and social dynamics that might be influencing the child's struggles, and then provide a comprehensive set of suggestions. Following that discussion, we actually document our recommendations. We send the recommendations to the primary care, as well as send them a care guide, which may be related to their concerns. So if a child has anxiety or depression, we'll send them a care guide describing how to treat those conditions. The desire is to both address the care for that particular child and family, and also build the primary care's capacity to address that in the next child that they see. So it's that specific child, but increasing abilities down the road.
So it's from a provider's standpoint, you don't have patients.
Correct. The people who call us are providers, and as Dr. Pedersen will show, it's a wide range of provider types, but not direct care to patients themselves and their families.
So in terms of outreach to primary care, what we learned within the first month of Opal K launching was that the people who were calling in were those who had had some sort of direct contact with somebody on the staff of Opal K. And so it also happened to coincide with the time I retired from clinical practice. And so I at the time owned a very small RV. So I spent a month traveling around the state and opening the doors to every tiny little clinic I could find. And the map you see is mostly the result of that trip. We also have had some more local outreach done by one of our other staff members. In addition, we attend conferences for the Family Practice Association and the Pediatric Association. We follow the guidelines of Washington State. Their primary outreach is by doing educational symposiums. So we recently did a symposium down in Medford, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. And then lastly, the Oregon Pediatric Society has a training program called the START program. And with each of those relevant START programs, there's a slide about Opal K. And in the packets that the providers get, there is a brochure or a flyer about Opal K. The results of that outreach have been this slide, which shows color-coded who the MDs, DOs, family nurse practitioners, and other providers who are actually registered through Opal K. The next slide here shows over the past few years, the gray bars are the number of enrollees that we've had, and then the blue bars are the calls that we've received over the following years. The green bars are about the foster care psychotropic medication prescribing program that Ajit's going to talk about a little bit later. And again, I think what this slide does not show in those blue bars, but what the child psychiatrists will corroborate, is that the complexity of the calls over time have increased. As the primary care providers become more confident dealing with kind of baseline things, they start calling in about more complicated issues. So we think that the educational effort has really had that effect.
This is a bar graph showing the number of calls that some providers will utilize OPAL-K. So in some counties, we'll have providers who have called us. This is just over the last year. Sometimes we'll have people who call us 10, 15, 20 times about a range of cases. So people are individual providers who are super users are finding this very beneficial. And then they themselves are the super users in their pediatric group or primary care setting, and then are helping their colleagues improve their services as well.
So why isn't Clackamas County and Multnomah County on there?
Because it's for rural counties, I think.
That's a good question. Why isn't that?
Because this one, it does. This slide reflects just rural communities. We do have other slides. The majority of the calls do come from Multnomah County because that's where the majority of the patients and encounters are.
Here's the slide that shows. Yes.
Senator Steinhardt.
Thank you, Dr. Jayamalani. For patients where there's an ongoing need, is there the capacity to have the primary care provider interact with the same psychiatrist, or is it whoever happens to be covering the OPAL-K line on a given day? How does that continuity relationship work?
Chair Monis Anderson and Senator Steiner Hayward, what's interesting is that we have six child psychiatrists who man person the phones. Some providers will selectively choose which day they want to call because they like working with a particular child psychiatrist. And sometimes a individual child psychiatrist will call back and say, how's this kid doing? We will offer to schedule a time. The customer's always right here, so we really try and provide whatever it is that the primary care prefers.
Thank you.
So as you can see, about 28% of our calls are coming from rural settings and about 72% from urban, and that represents the population pretty much directly. You asked Senator Monis Anderson about diagnoses. So our top diagnosis is anxiety. Some youth will have multiple diagnoses. Our top is anxiety. Second is ADHD. And then third is depression. And fourth actually is a combination of autism or intellectual disabilities. Mm-hmm. And the top three reflect what the epidemiology tells us about mental health conditions in childhood. This is also interesting, and this is our age and sex of calls. And what's interesting is early on in life, we get a lot more calls about boys, and later on in life, a lot more calls about girls. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because young children and boys in particular tend to have more externalizing challenges, so hyperactivity, aggression. And then girls tend to struggle with anxiety, depression. And across the board, we started now to collect data around how many youth present with trauma in their histories. And that's actually a very high level of concern and a frequent concern, and we're now starting to track that as well.
Yes, sir. Sorry, one more quick question. Not uncommonly, kids with mental health issues also have family members with mental health issues. We know that there's a genetic component. We also know that there can be exacerbating conditions. What's the capacity to connect? I mean, sometimes, obviously, the child psychiatrist can do a great job of helping the primary care provider coach the parents and make sure that they access. But how do you address access issues for the parents who may also need some treatment as well?
Chair Monis Anderson and Senator Steiner Hayward, that's an excellent question. Through the conversation, if it looks like that might be the primary area of need that the provider has is to find services for their parent, then our staff will help look at what the CCO access is or the commercial payers are in that area or that for that patient and their family and try and support their primary care in that access issue. Other states, Massachusetts is probably the most famous for this, have created a early childhood perinatal health call line. So if there's a mom who's depressed or who's using substances, they use their call line to actually connect that that dyad to care in that local community, which is another interesting strategy that these services can provide.
But we don't yet have an Opal A, as it were.
We don't have Opal A or Opal G, and if you find that the data is compelling, I think that really is where to go next, is to expand. We know how to do this now in Oregon. We've had a lot of success. We know what the challenges are, and it would be quite readily available to expand this to adults. And also, the core issue of geriatric care is a massive challenge as well. Mm-hmm.
If I may interject, Chair Monis Anderson and Steiner Hayward, when going out in the rural areas, when I talk about Opal K, they repeatedly the response I get is, "Yeah, but what about Opal A? Where is there going to be Opal A?" So it is one that people are directly asking for as well.
Hmm. I would think, if I may, Madam Chair, that actually, I mean, I know that right now Opal K is funded on a separate funding stream from Medicaid dollars because obviously it serves commercial patients as well. But now that this is a proven thing, it's not a proof of concept anymore, I do wonder if we need to be rethinking how we do the funding streams for programs like this, because obviously it's saving both commercial payers and Medicaid money to have access to skilled child psychiatrists on an ongoing basis, and yet the payment is coming almost exclusively from general fund, which I'm, as a budget geek, somewhat ambivalent about, to say the least.
So thank you for that question, Senator Steiner Hayward and Chair Monis Anderson. A cautionary tale. One of the things that a couple of states tried to do was to make this a pay-for-service event. Just to yeah. clarify that piece, if a primary care has to think about what the insurance is, get pre-authorization, or somebody has to bill, this thing dies. So I think what you're saying is there should be cost sharing in some strategy to create a cost sharing arrangement. I don't know what that would look like.
I mean, you could envision a model where, you know, we have a capitation rate for CCOs for adult patients, for kids. You could envision saying, okay, we're taking $2, $3 from every kid and $5 from every adult, and we're funneling it towards these psychiatric access lines and providing that service, and we work with our commercial insurers to figure out how to get them to pay in the system as well, because they're clearly benefiting from it, whether they're a straight commercial or a third-party administrator, they're benefiting from it as well. So we need to be thinking more about how do we construct pay. I agree. I would not talk about a pay-as-you-go structure. I think that makes no sense whatsoever for exactly the reasons you outlined. But I think we could be thinking about it a little differently.
There is a model for that. And again, Massachusetts, which was the first place that created these programs, has an 18 cents per member per month fee for all individuals in the state. And that is contributed to this project. That's how they've strategized that. And that was our original proposal, by the way.
Got it. And when I was looking at numbers, it's like you had, I think, 600 calls, total calls in a year. Is that
approximately?
So that's like average of two a day. I mean,
this is sort of like having the plane on the tarmac, gassed up, ready to go. The staff are in the plane, and you might have an empty plane, or you might have 8 calls, 10 calls, but you need the staff there. Some other states have tried to do it by having the child psychiatrist see patients and do other things and then work these calls in, and it has not been timely, so there's a lot of delays in the call. The primary care might have the patient in their office, and so trying to deliver it immediately requires these gaps in time. So that's why we've added some other aspects of our work to try and utilize that open time without charging more money, but just use those providers to do other things, which is our foster care project, for instance.
Thank you.
So this is one of the things we decided to do was help DHS in implementing HB 3114 from 2009, which was the desire to improve appropriate oversight of psychotropic prescribing for youth in foster care. And Opal K is now has taken that project over. But this basically is some brief graphs about the use of antipsychotic medicine for use in youth in in foster care has diminished significantly over the past 3 years, 4 years. The percent of children in foster care on a psychotropic in 2009, when the legislation occurs, it was 19.6%, and now we're at 9.8%. What this means is, I think, that we're identifying trauma, addressing psychosocial elements, providing better care for and earlier for kids in foster care. I know that may sound hard to believe, but we are seeing that kids in foster care are getting better care earlier. And this is an interesting side benefit to this focus, is that from all of Medicaid from 2002 to 2015, we've seen a very dramatic reduction in the use of antipsychotic medicines, first-time prescriptions for people under 18. The reason why this is important is many reasons. I think we're utilizing these powerful medicines more appropriately, and this allows us to not have to worry about diabetes and other adverse health conditions. Monitoring costs, tremendous potential adverse outcomes to inappropriate use of antipsychotics.
Okay. As I mentioned, one of the other outreach efforts we did was a symposium, educational symposium down in Medford this year. It was actually quite successful. It was well received, and we decided we would like to continue to do this type of outreach at least once or twice a year. We have one scheduled for next spring in the Portland metropolitan area. Our next location after that will be Pendleton. The following slide just shows that, yeah, they liked us, but it also shows we're not perfect because the data got chopped off. Sorry. another thing that we ask each of the Opal K callers to please complete a post call survey, letting us know how we're doing. So the statements are: I find Opal K consults to be helpful. I was treated professionally. I was able to reach the consultant in a timely manner, and the process of being connected was actually positive. Again, most people strongly agree. My patient received mental health assistance more quickly because of Opal K. Less robust answers there, but I think that just reflects that this is a telephone consult service. I mean, even though we try and get people into services, there just aren't enough services around. More recently, we've added the two other statements: I'm better able to care for my patient after consulting with Opal K, and I'm more comfortable addressing mental health issues in my practice knowing I have Opal K as a backup. And again, most people say, yeah, it really makes a difference to me. We ask people to provide comments if they're willing. We have hundreds of comments. I'm going to read just one of them, but we'd be happy to provide as many as you want. But that top comment from Jackson County, always very helpful. Thanks to a series of Opal K consults, the Opal K team has helped me wean a child who was on 4 psych drugs down to a single drug regimen of Intuniv with much improved current function and significantly decreased long-term risk of complications from drug side effects. Both the family and I say thank you. So it's really, more than the graphs and anything else, it's the stories that people tell us about this is really making a difference for us.
So an added element that we thought we should add, we learned from the experience in New Mexico, which is the pioneer in a project called Extensions of Community Health Outcomes. And this project was intended to address hepatitis C in New Mexico, very difficult to get access. What they did was they created a structure whereby a group of primary care providers from various rural settings will call once a week into a telephonic system where your head's on in a picture, you have the picture of the consultants, and the university experts are sitting at a table. And every Friday, let's say for an hour at lunchtime, they listen to a lecture, 20 minutes. The primary carers all agree to present a story. They present a story about a youth and family. The Experts then discuss the case, and then specialists will provide support. So you might have you'll have a child psychiatrist, a pediatrician, a pharmacist, and a peer support specialist at the table providing feedback to the primary care about that case. And they'll do that for 30 visits, and they'll get an hour of CME for each of those visits. And Terry's going to tell you about the outcome of that project. This was a project that is the first in the United States for child psychiatry. Adult psychiatry, this is the fastest growing ECHO model, actually internationally now. This is an international approach.
So both the outreach and the evaluation of the program was done through ORPRIN, the Oregon Rural Practice-Based Research Network.
Yes.
The collaboration with them was really positive. It was a delight to work with them. So as you can see from this map, our providers that participated were far flung across the state. Some of the results show that, again, we're looking at comfort level at assessing and treating different disorders, and the short bars on the top were pre-ECHO program, and the longer bars at the bottom were post-feeling, saying that people felt more comfortable assessing and treating behavioral disorders as well as mood and anxiety disorders.
We need to...
Yeah, okay. And then lastly, they also just a whole bunch of things, you know, I increase my knowledge, increase my confidence, I'm more well-informed about symptoms. All of those things, again, people felt were quite positive. This one shows how comfortable primary care providers are at providing counseling regarding pediatric mental health challenges. Blue is a good color. Green and dark green are colors we would prefer not to see. So we see a decrease in green and increase in blue. So increased comfort at actually providing counseling in the primary care office. This is about comfort in prescribing medication. Again, blue and dark blue are positives. Green and dark green, less comfort. And again, this is pre on the top, post on the bottom. So significantly increased comfort in treating pharmacologically these disorders, with the exception of psychosis, which even though people felt more comfortable, everyone agrees we'd really like child psychiatrists to be involved with that. I think the one thing that the slides don't really cover are, again, the stories that people tell and the reflection that people said between the combination of this ECHO project, which increased my baseline knowledge, and the fact that I have Opal K to be able to call, there is so much more that I'm willing to assess in my primary care office and treat in my primary care office. So thank you again, Senator Monis Anderson.
Thank you very much for appreciating good information. All right, the last thing on our agenda is the Oregon Tribes Dental Health Aid Therapist Pilot Project. Pam Johnson.
Hi, my name is Pam Johnson. I'm with the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board. We are an organization that serves the 43 federally recognized tribes of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. We work for those tribes to do health promotion and disease prevention and policy change to support those. Today, I want to give an update on our tribal dental pilot project, and thank you for having me here today. I just want to start with a very, very quick historical context of why our project is important. I think when talking about Indian health and Indian health systems, it's good to have some of that context. And I want to start with this map of Oregon and looking at the western part of the states and recognizing that in the early 50s, all of over 60 bands and tribes were terminated in Oregon. And this stripped those members of their enrollment, of lands, and of resources that were guaranteed by treaties and by federal policy. Termination failed American Indians. It's not surprising that their culture, their identity, and governance were not improved with the Termination Act, and that impacted their education and health outcomes. Through the hard work of tribes across the United States to get through termination, it was recognized by the 70s that this was a failed policy and that self-determination and self-governance were a better way to go for American Indians. And this also combined with a long-fought battle for sovereignty to be restored to the tribes in Oregon. So in the 80s, we saw these six tribes now in Washington, Oregon, be restored and be able to govern themselves. Warm Spring, we now also have the resources through the IHS to run our own health programs in some of these tribes. And so in Washington, or in Oregon State, there's only one tribe, Warm Springs, that is still a direct service tribe with the IHS, and everybody else runs their own health programs. So this era of self-governance has allowed Oregon tribes to build their own health programs. It recognizes that tribal leaders know best what is good for their communities. And it's in this context that some of our tribes have chosen to pilot dental therapy and to meet the staggering oral health needs of their members. And I just want to show a few slides of those staggering oral health needs. This is national IHS data, surveillance data, that shows that American Indian and Alaska Native kids suffer four times more untreated decay than white kids. And if you looked at Portland area statistics, you would see that it looks pretty much exactly the same as the national statistics. And then if you look at adults, we also have some pretty staggering outcomes in that. This is compared to Healthy People's 2020 objectives. For 35 to 44-year-olds, we see that 65% of adults have untreated tooth decay, and in 65 to 74-year-olds, 45%. So clearly, there's a problem. What are the barriers? Why are we seeing these numbers? There's a shortage and high turnover rate of dentists in tribal communities. About a fifth of the positions for dentists in the IHS are always open. There's a lack of resources. IHS is chronically underfunded by the federal government. The cost of care is in any dental setting is high. There's also historical trauma. So when your care used to be a dentist coming in once a year and pulling teeth, That historical trauma actually goes through all generations and impacts people wanting to come in and actually see a dentist or a dental provider. There's a lack of culturally competent providers. Less than 0.1% of all dentists are American Indian. And geographic isolation. Most of our tribes live in geographically isolated rural communities. So when looking at what to do next in Oregon, the tribes looked north to Alaska, where in 2006, they brought in a provider called a dental health aid therapist. The model was not new to Alaska. It was, it's been around since the 20s. It's in a bunch of different countries. Dental therapists now practice in 54 countries and in several states in the United States. They're authorized in Alaska, Maine, Vermont, Minnesota, Washington. They're authorized on tribal lands. In Oregon, we have our pilots. In Alaska, there's an education program to train the dental health aid therapists, and it's a partnership with the tribal college, Illisavik Tribal College. It offers a 2-calendar-year curriculum, so it's very accessible. People can get in and out in 2 years. And students graduate now with an Associate of Applied Sciences, which is new in the past year. They also, after they do their education program, do a 400-hour preceptorship with their supervising dentist. The difference between a DHAT and a dentist, one of the differences is their scope of practice. They do about 50 procedures versus what a dentist does, about 500. And that scope of practice was really built around what are the basic, most needed procedures facing our communities. And so it's a lot of the basic preventive and restorative procedures. They do a full year in clinic when they're in school, and so they are doing all of these procedures on live bodies for a year. So we know the DHAT model is working in Alaska. There's over 50 certified DHATs in 80 communities. They stay in those communities. About 80% of DHATs are still working in the communities that they started from. One of the reasons is because they are directly recruited from their communities, so they go home and they stay there. They've 45,000 more Alaska Natives are being served with dental care than before DHATs entered the pictures. And then also the dental teams are really allowing everybody to practice at the top of of their scope. So while the DHATs are doing some of the more preventive, restorative work and fillings, the dentists are actually able to do much more complicated care that they were never able to provide in these smaller communities. Just some more statistics on how well it's working in Alaska. You can see they've increased in one of the areas, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, the dental exams per month are going up and the emergency room trips are going down. The financial impact of expanding the dental team, these are numbers from both Alaska and Minnesota, where you can see that dental therapists cost employers less than 30 cents of every dollar they generate. And so for safety net clinics, tribal clinics, who are most of them are struggling just to stay alive, they're able to have these resources to expand their access as well. And this is our newest data that's come in on dental health aid therapists. It's 1 month old, published from the University of Washington from a public health dentist there, Dr. Donald Chi. He's been studying and working with DHATs in Alaska for 10 years and did this study to look at actual oral health outcomes. This provider's been around long enough to look at oral health outcomes instead of just access. And there's some pretty amazing results. They looked at communities that had DHATs versus didn't have DHATs. In the communities with DHATs, there was almost 300% decrease in kids that needed their four front teeth extracted, which is a fairly common procedure of kids in Alaska, which means they need to go into the operating room and have that full mouth restoration. There's a 44% decrease in general anesthesia and a 60% increase in preventive care. So we know looking at this that we're not just talking about access and getting more people in the chair, but they're actually having access or outcome improvements. And saying, oh, I just showed the children. I was going to show the adults as well, but they're seeing not just in children, but also in adults in Alaska. So since there are so many successes in Alaska, tribes in the lower 48 were very excited to start working with dental therapists in their own tribal communities. And in Oregon, it seemed the best fit for authorization to go through the pilot project model, which was authorized by the state legislature in 2011, to increase access to oral health care by looking at different provider models, accelerating existing categories, and teaching new oral health care roles to previously untrained persons. So the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board worked with our initial sites, the Confederated Tribes of Kuslo or Umpqua and Siuslaw Indians, the Coquille Indian Tribe, and the Native American Rehabilitation Association, and putting together an application for a pilot to pilot dental therapists in their tribes and in their organization. And we were approved in February of last year.
Finally.
And when we started this project in 2015, working with the tribes and starting on our application, we realized that we were going to have to send some students that were going to be trained for 2 years in order to come back and have boots on the ground when we were approved and ready to go. And so this is Naomi Petrie. She was a brave pioneer that said, yes, I will go get trained, even though you guys don't have authorization yet for me to practice as a DHAT when I get home. But it's what I really want to do, and I want to serve my community. So 2 years ago, she went to Alaska, has been in training for 2 years. She graduated in June. She came back in July and is now working at her tribal dental clinic. She's still in her preceptorship with her supervising dentist. So what that means is that everything she does has direct supervision. The dentist is checking in on both ends of the visit, is in the clinic the whole time and supervising very closely. And this is really to build the relationship between the DHAT and the dentist and to make sure they're speaking the same language. The dentist is comfortable with everything that the DHAT is doing, knows her strengths and weaknesses, and then that is put into a practice plan at the end. So in the rare case that there would be a procedure where the dentist was like, I just want to keep doing those, they could choose not to put that in the practice plan.
Senator Steiner Harewood.
Thank you. It occurs to me, Ms. Johnson, first of all, hooray. We've been waiting a long time for this.
Yes.
And I'm very excited. But it does occur to me to think that, you know, it's interesting to think about whether we're making sure that young people in our tribal communities have the educational background that will prepare them to go through the kind of training that Ms. Petrie
has done, and whether you're partnering, for example, with the AHECs, the Area Health Education Centers, to use this, because this is a new opportunity for students, right,
mm-hmm.
and in rural communities in general. So I'm curious whether that is a possibility, because we know the AHECs do a really good job of recruiting young people into health professions and helping make sure that they're prepared for the training that they need, because obviously this is pretty intensive, and we need to make sure that they're well prepared to serve our patients.
Absolutely, and it's interesting because in the Alaska DHAT training program, most of the people going in, many of them just have high school education. So Naomi came straight out of high school, went into the program, and so they're absolutely prepared to work with students who have just had a high school graduation. Many of them have been dental assistants, have a little bit more familiarity, know that this is sort of what they want to do, and so they like to see that as well. But they've started working. I mean, when you are recruiting from the community, you need to be able to provide an education that starts post-secondary.
Right.
And so the education program in Alaska really has made that a very – they have wraparound services when the students start to make sure they have everything they need. If there's any areas where they feel like they need more mentoring, they actually provide that for them.
Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what kinds of procedures does a DHAT perform, and how does it compare to dental health hygienist?
Right. So here's some of the main procedures that DHAT does. And when you talk to clinicians, which I am not, they talk about DHATs and dentists working above the gum line above the gum line, and hygienists working below. And so that's sort of one of the main differences. But when you look at all the services that a person needs and they come into a clinic, there's plenty of work for a DHAT and a dental therapist and a dentist. And so in the places where they're working in Alaska and Minnesota, there's been no indication that there's been replacement of providers because of a dental therapist, that it really is additive, and it's helping provide procedures and services and community education, which is a big part of this as well, going out into the Head Starts, going out into the community, getting two-year-olds really familiar with holding a toothbrush and holding their floss, that all of that work can be expanded with a dental therapist.
And it's a two-year training program?
It's a two-year training program. In Alaska, it is. In Minnesota, it's a little bit longer, the Alaska program is going through trying to be accredited by the Commission on Dental Accreditation. They're going to be the first program accredited. They're first going through. They think they might have to extend their curriculum a small amount, but their goal is to keep it in a two-year. And it's a three-year academic program squeezed into 2 years. Mm-hmm. So they go 9 to 5. They take 1 month off during the year. And so it really is an intense schedule to get through their curriculum.
We actually have an Oregonian that went to Minnesota and was trained there, mm-hmm. and would love to be able to work here because this is where her home is, but hasn't been able to because of our system here.
So we also have an experienced DHAT now working at the Northwest Native American Rehabilitation Association in Portland. So this is Ben Stewart. He's a DHAT. He graduated from the DHAT education program in 2009 and has been working in Alaska since then for 7 years. But he's actually a member of the Cow Creek tribe here in Oregon, has always wanted to come home, and there was an opportunity to start working at the NARA clinic. And so he just started 2 weeks ago. So he is our newest DHAT who's practicing. And I want to tell you a little bit more about NARA because it is an urban Indian program. It's in Portland. They started in 1970 originally just to do outpatient substance abuse, and they've grown till now where they have a residential family treatment center, child and family services, wellness center, primary health clinic, adult mental health services, transitional housing, and then 1 year ago they opened up their dental clinic. And so they are full service. They have a huge clientele. There's about 16,000 1,000 American Indians that live in the Portland area. And so this is one place where they can go for care. They are also an FQHC in Portland, and so they don't just see American Indians. They see about 60% American Indians, about 40% non. And the thing that's exciting about NARA is we talk about integrative models of care with behavioral and dental and medical, and having all these services and practice settings in which a DHAT could go and do screenings and do education, and in some cases have a chair in their medical clinic, provides a lot of opportunities. With all of the tribes that we work with, we don't start with, okay, what's this new provider going to do, but how is this going to change your delivery system of care? And a lot of times the clinics will go, you know what, ideally what we need to be doing is getting out instead of having people come in. We need to be going to places where our members are. And so NARA is going to be an exciting place to integrate some of that care with Ben's services.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Follow up on your comment. I think that's great, but how is his ability to do that in Oregon, based on the other question, is because he's working in a tribal facility?
It's because he's authorized through our pilot project. Yes. So there's no, right, we're doing this. We had to write the application and say, this is what we're going to do, and that is what's giving us the authority to do this at this point. And then we're going to bring all this data back in a couple years and say, this is working really well. Hopefully that's what we'll be saying, and we can get legislation passed to authorize this permanently is the end goal. So this was just the slide showing the number of American Indians in Portland. And then these are students that are in Alaska right now. So we have three students that are in their second clinical year. One more student from the Confederated Tribes of Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians. And then we've got two students that will be coming back to the Coquill Indian Tribe. And then we have one student who's actually a member of the Chickasaw Tribe, and she'll be graduating in 2 years and coming back to NARA. Part of the pilot project is making sure that we're evaluating measurable outcomes and monitoring for patient safety and quality of care. And so these are the three buckets of information that we're going to be looking at, or are looking at, as we move through this project. What evidence is there that pilot has expanded access to dental services and education? How has the pilot improved clinical productivity, patient safety, quality of dental care, patient satisfaction, and how has the pilot impacted the productivity of the oral health team and costs of dental care in tribal communities? So we've written and implemented an evaluation plan and are implementing a pretty substantial monitoring plan as well. I want to talk a little bit about the monitoring of safety and quality, because it comes up often as a concern from people, is how can we make sure that patients are safe. And first of all, our initial pilot application was reviewed by a technical review board and the Oregon Health and approved by the Oregon Health Authority. And then they approved of the DHAT education program. The graduates cannot complete their degree without showing competency in every single procedure. They have their full year's worth of clinic work, and then they have their 400 plus hours on top of that with direct supervision and a checklist of having to show that they know how to do each of the procedures and show that 8 times. So it's pretty rigorous. They also have, we have to follow all of the OARs that are regulating the pilots. And part of that is approval of informed consent on every procedure that they actually get from the DHAT. On top of that, we have an external dentist that we will contract with that's going to review charts on a quarterly basis. So we have to take images of all irreversible procedures before and after to go into the charts. Those will be reviewed by an external dentist on a quarterly basis. The supervising dentist after the preceptorship will be reviewing all charts of external irreversible procedures. We have patient and provider satisfaction surveys that we will be doing on a quarterly basis. And then we had to go through IRB in order to make sure that we are doing right by our tribal patients. On top of that, we also have external Oregon Health Authority review, and so we have quarterly data reports that are on every patient and every procedure coming in that the DHAT sees into the Oregon Health Authority. They have yearly site visits that they'll do to the training facility. So Dr. Austin and Sarah Kowalski just got back last week from their site review in Alaska. They will also do a yearly site review to the clinics participating. They will do yearly chart reviews where they are taking all of the charts, random samples of the charts, and reviewing them as well. And then we also have a very robust advisory committee reviewing all of our documents and our protocol. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of eyes on this project, and we are at this point moving through the part where it feels like we may be looking at it so much that our data might be slowed down and impacted, but we understand that it's important, and we know that after the first year, we'll see some of those measurable outcomes actually reflect that workforce improvement. I want to come back and just say this is not just working for tribal communities across the United States, and so we think it's important when we're providing this information about dental therapists to look at what else is going on in Oregon. Are there other communities in Oregon that are facing some of these same barriers to care that tribal communities are? And we know that the answer is yes. We know that tooth decay was widespread among children. This is 2012 data from the SMILES survey. These are tooth decay rates across the state, really high in Southeast Oregon. We know 60% of young people ages 1 to 20 with Medicaid coverage did not see a dentist in 2014. And then we know that pretty much the entire state is covered with dental health professional shortage areas for geographic and low-income reasons. And so this is a map showing those dental HPSAs. And that means over 1 million Oregonians lived in areas with shortage of dentists in 2015. So we think that providing information about this model of care, this new provider, is something that the state should be looking at for all communities and not just tribal communities. This is findings, I won't read through them, from the latest Oral Health and Oregon CCO's metrics report from OHA that just came out this year, and these are some of the findings on some of the challenges that still remain on CCOs and oral health care. And then this is a map of the United States of where other states are looking at authorizing dental therapists. And this is a map that I love to show every year, one, because it grows every year. I also have to say it grows so fast every year that I never have the most recent one. For example, we now have authorization in Washington for tribal communities that doesn't show up on the map. But we also, Arizona is starting, has introduced legislation and is taking a look at it very carefully. And so we feel like it's a matter of when and not if. Every piece of information coming out about this provider model is positive, and we're excited to be a part of this pilot right now.
Great. Thank you so much,
Thank you.
Kim. Is there any other questions? And once they start, it's important for us to receive updates on how many patients you're seeing and also what kind of procedures. Do they do scoop and fill or...
And they're doing, I mean, they do fillings.
Yeah.
And so we will be turning in all of that data on a quarterly basis to the Oregon Health Authority. So whatever you want to see, we can certainly get that to you.
And how many inch extractions and.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Madam Chair, can you remind me, Ms. Johnson, what's the plan for how long we're going to let the pilot run before we start spreading this out and just authorizing them statewide? Because. Frankly, I don't want to end up with paralysis through analysis of something we already know works.
Right. Well, that, you know, it's sort of a decision that those involved in the pilots are going to have to make. Do we feel confident that we have the information we need to bring to the legislature to show? And, of course, we went into this project feeling like we've seen this work in so many other places, and there's so much good data. But we've also chosen to go through the pilot process. And so for that integrity...
Well, we couldn't pass legislation unless it was a pilot.
Right. So we are going through that pilot. pilot process. We will consider when we work with legislators to bring legislation. There's other people thinking about running pilots on dental therapy too, so that's also a question of if there's another dental therapy pilot, a non-tribal dental therapy pilot, how will that impact all of this? But we would be excited to run legislation as soon as we felt like there was the support and the data and the analysis that was necessary to really support our work.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. No further questions? All right.
Thank you.
Any other announcements that I need to make, Cassie? All right. With that, we're adjourned. Cassie. All right. With that, we're adjourned.